You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Roy Idelson, who is the former executive director of the University of Pennsylvania's Solomon Asch Center for Study of Ethnopolitical Conflict and a past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. His work focuses on applying psychological knowledge to issues of social justice and political change. His writing has appeared in a variety of scholarly peer-reviewed journals and other outlets, including the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, and he is the author of a terrific new book called Political Mind Games: How the 1% Manipulate Our Understanding of What's Happening, What's Right, and What's Possible. You can follow Roy Idelson online at royidelson.com and on Twitter at Roy Idelson. Roy, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's great to be with you.
Great to have you on. Should have had you on before now, but this is a wonderful reason why. This is a terrific book, Political Mind Games. People do put up with a heck of a lot without rising up and changing those in power. And I take it you think at least one big reason is that people are lied to.
I think it's one of the really crucial reasons. There are others. We know that the 1% have tremendous control in terms of our politics and influencing our elected officials. And they also have a lot of influence in terms of the mainstream media, in terms of what narratives are promoted and which ones aren't. But I think the biggest or the least recognized source of influence is the manipulation that they engage in, the psychological appeals that lead us toward division or paralysis. We far outnumber those with tremendous wealth and power. But if they can divide us, if they can make us think that change is not possible, if they can persuade us that what they're doing is actually for the common good, it pacifies us. And I think that's what happens pretty much all the time.
The 1% do have some help, right? Everybody who works in the corporate media and in schools and so forth isn't among the 1%, but are perhaps doing their bidding.
Yes, right. Yeah. And when I say 1%, I'm really focusing on those with tremendous wealth and power who are self-interested. There are people with extraordinary wealth who do very good things. I'm focused on those who are out for themselves. And yes, they have the resources to get all the help they need from others, unfortunately.
So this book, Political Mind Games, is sort of a catalog of types of lies that we're told. Is it intended as a sort of a guidebook to prepare people to spot lies and not fall for them?
That's exactly what I hope it accomplishes. The psychological research, for example, shows that there's a phenomenon called attitude inoculation, and basically, it's like a flu shot. We get a flu shot so that we're exposed to certain antibodies, and as a result, we're better able to deal with that virus in the wild, so to speak. And what I'm trying to do is offer psychological inoculation. If we are prepared to recognize the manipulative appeals or the mind games, and we are prepared with counter arguments to them, then we're less susceptible to be influenced by them. And those who are less susceptible, in a sense, can become the first responders, those who are able to go out and communicate with others, including others who have differing points of view, and try and share the message that we need to, recognize that we're being fooled, that we're being deceived, that we can have policies that work for everyone instead of the 1%. And my research over many years now as a psychologist has led me to identify five areas where we're especially susceptible to manipulation. And those are issues of vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness. Those are kind of five templates through which we make sense of the world around us. So if we hear messages that tap into any of those, they can sound true, even though they're a pack of lies.
So let's talk about each of those if we have time, or at least a sample. What about vulnerability? What's an example there?
Well, among the basic questions we ask ourselves pretty much every day is, are we safe? Are the people we care about in harm's way? We want to have an answer to that, and we're not always right in the judgments we make, but whatever judgments we make in that regard influence the actions we take and the policies that we support. So, you know, for example, in the book, I identify four vulnerability mind games that are used regularly by the 1%. They are, first, it's a dangerous world. This is when we're told that our actions are necessary to protect us from dire threats. This is a basic message when we are being persuaded that we need to invade one country or another. Second vulnerability appeal that works in the opposite direction is change is dangerous. And what the 1% try and do here is convince us that the status quo is what we really want to maintain. They certainly want to maintain the status quo. It's enormously rewarding for them to do so. But they'll argue that change is dangerous in order to push us away from something like Medicare for All or a Green New Deal or higher taxes, any of those areas. The third of the four vulnerability appeals is it's a false alarm. And this is where those in positions of influence try and tell us that the warnings we're receiving from others, often those who are not in the positions of power, are overblown. This is the basic effort to deny climate change and the dire consequences, for example. The 1% will tell us it's a false alarm. It's not as big a problem as they out there are saying. You know, we've always risen to the occasion in the United States. We will figure this out too, and therefore don't get caught up in the effort to, you know, dramatically shift our policies away from the oil and gas industry. And the fourth vulnerability appeal is we'll make you sorry. And this one's a little different than the other three in that in many ways, it's simply a warning that if you try and interfere with the way things are, with the way those in power want them to be, you'll pay a price, and potentially a serious price. And that definitely, we have to take that seriously. I mean, people, that scares people away often from the collective action that we're ultimately we will need.
It seems pretty complex in that it's not clear that we're as a population too afraid or insufficiently afraid. I mean, it seems that we're terrified of Muslim terrorists, even though they shoot many fewer people than toddlers who find guns lying around the home, and nobody's afraid of toddlers who find guns. We're supposed to be afraid of secret cells of Hezbollah in Venezuela that are going to take over the United States and limit our freedoms, but nobody's afraid of nuclear apocalypse. Go ahead and, you know, push NATO into Eastern Europe and threaten Russia, and that's all cool. I'm not worried. I'm not a coward. It seems we need to be afraid in different places than we are being afraid.
I agree with you, and those are great examples and distinctions. And I would think with each one of them, we could look at who benefits from promoting one type of fear versus another. And there are entire industries that rely on certain kind of fear-mongering. So, you know, defense contractors, well, of course, they make money. The more we make bombs or drones or whatever it may be.
And they've trained us to call it defense as well.
That's right. Well, yes, good point. You know, there's an incident with I mentioned in the book where Jeb Bush, this is a few years ago before he failed to become the Republican candidate, talking to a group of defense contractors. And, you know, whether he intended that everyone, the public would know, I doubt. But he basically concluded, you know, invading Iraq turned out to be a pretty good deal. Now, pretty good deal, he was saying, and it's true, for Lockheed, for Halliburton, for companies like that. The whole surveillance state, that we should be afraid hyper afraid of terrorism and Muslims and people who are different. Well, again, there's a lot of money to be made in that. And there are all kinds of, you know, homeland security contractors. They get enormous paydays because Americans hold distrustful or prejudiced or they're different from us views about certain people. That's an example of the distrust mind games that I also talk about. So, you know, we're and at the same time, you know, if guns kill people, but the NRA is not going to push in that direction. Instead, they will turn it around and argue, using a helplessness mind game, that we'll all be helpless if we are not allowed to have any gun we want and as many of them as we want. And people don't like, understandably, to feel helpless. Now, we wouldn't be helpless, but that doesn't matter. If the NRA can tap into our worries about being in a world where we have no control, that's going to be effective. And that's one of the types of arguments that we need to combat by recognizing that it's false and being prepared. We know we're going to hear it. We know that's we're going to hear that every time there's a massacre, whether it be, you know, anywhere in the country.
Yeah. We're speaking with Roy Idleson. The book is Political Mind Games, How the 1% Manipulate Our Understanding of What's Happening, What's Right, and What's Possible. Jumping from the first down to the fifth category of lies we're told, the ones about helplessness, seems to suggest that in fact there's another sense in which people do like feeling helpless, are accepting of absolutely ridiculous claims. That they have no power to change the world, that nonviolent actions have never occurred, there was no civil rights movement, women never, you know, gained the right to vote, or if they did, they did so somehow magically by voting, because that's the one thing you can do other than sit and whine and moan, mm-hmm. is to vote. People seem to me, and this seems more important to me than any other type of lie, the lie that we're powerless to do anything, seems very, very important and absolutely ridiculous, but widely accepted.
I think part of why that is, and I try and explain it in this way, relates to the psychological phenomenon of status quo bias. Basically, we tend to prefer the way the world is to alternatives that are less familiar to us. There's something, in terms of anxiety, comforting about the familiar. And that can lead us in all kinds of terrible directions in terms of maintaining policies that are totally abhorrent and destructive. So one of the helplessness mind games I write about is change is impossible. Message from the 1% being, this is how the world is. It can't be changed. We might wish it could be. And they'll go to issues like human nature as though it's beyond our capability as people to behave more decently toward those who are less familiar to us. It's not true, but when we accept that kind of these circumstances are not the creation of powerful people and powerful groups who want us in this position, if we think that, in fact, well, you know, it just things turned out this way. This is the way things evolved. We're much more accepting of it, and we don't know who to fight back against. Part of the way the 1% use helplessness is by denying their own culpability. You know, that the world is this way not because of what we do, not because of our priorities, which are self-serving and make us fabulously wealthy. So don't blame us. And part of collective action, in my view, part of what gives it its power is being able to recognize the target that needs to be addressed. Where the problem lies, where the responsibility lies. And there's a way in which we can feel helpless because we're overwhelmed. We can't figure out, you know, how best to get out of the box we're in. And again, the status quo is something the 1% in this country created, and they're going to fight to keep it, and they're going to tell us that resistance is futile, that there's nothing we can do. And you mentioned some great examples of how that's obviously not true. The civil rights movement is clear on that.
Yeah, thousands of examples. Resistance is, in fact, fertile, not futile, right?
Right.
But It strikes me that a lot of times through your book and in other examples, the lies that are told go out of their way to be the exact opposite of the truth. That is, the minimum wage will hurt people paid the minimum wage. Here's a better way to help people without giving them any money. Or we need to starve the people of Venezuela in order to send them aid while starving them. Is this an effective way to fool people?
Well, unfortunately, it is, and the message, again, those were excellent examples, but we don't hear that full message. We just hear the part that reinforces the preferred policy of those in power. And part of what these mind games do is they trigger our emotions. And once we start being overly influenced by our emotional reactions, our reasoning suffers. So in terms of vulnerability, if we become fearful, we kind of lose track of how best to assess various risks. In terms of injustice, if we become angry, we have a harder time figuring out where the mistreatment lies and who's responsible for it. In terms of distrust, when we're suspicious, when we're overwhelmed with kind of doubts about whether someone can be trusted, it's much harder for us to work with them, to collaborate. And there's no doubt that societal change is going to depend on groups that at times are suspicious of each other for unwarranted reasons, coming together and realizing, well, we share much more in common than whatever differences those who want to keep us divided have emphasized. So, yeah, it's, I think the message or the problem, what's frustrating about these appeals is that they target concerns we have, and therefore it's as though we immediately accept them as true, and then we have to do the work of figuring out, oh, wait a minute, it's not true after all. But that immediate sense of, that sounds right, is powerfully effective, less so, and I guess the point I would emphasize, if we're prepared to hear those manipulative appeals, and if we recognize where the motivation for them comes from, if we know in advance that these are going to be deceptive efforts to protect the 1%, and that's why we're hearing them, then they're going to have less effect on us. And that's what we need. We need to be able, in a sense, to resist the psychological manipulation, just like we need to resist some of the awful policies that we're being faced with.
So is the best advice to people to be skeptical of what's on television news, to think about who benefits, to think about what's not being talked about or asked, or is it as important to tell people to go find better, more reliable sources of news and education?
I think you need to do both. But the motivation for us, for the public, to find better sources and more reliable sources is to have that skepticism of much of what's in the mainstream media and obviously outlets like Fox News. But at the same time, you know, one of the challenges is that within the main, what I'll call the mainstream media, are tremendous reporters and journalists doing, you know, incredible work, taking risks, providing us with accurate information. It really can be tricky to figure out, who to listen to and who not to. But one can do that, and there are a lot of alternative outlets that we should turn to more often. And again, if we know that we suspect that we're getting messages from, in a sense, from on high, from the corporate leaders, from politicians who are beholden to the 1%, we should be very, if not cynical, skeptical that they're giving us either an accurate picture or the full picture. And we just have to be open to challenging those ideas or looking for people who have challenged them. In other words, make sure you read or hear about the alternative perspective so that you're in a position to make better judgments. And collectively, we need to be better at critical thinking, you know. And
can't say that enough, Roy Idelson. I don't want to fail to acknowledge you as someone who has challenged a particular disastrous way of thinking in the United States in terms of your opposition to the acceptance of torture and the participation of psychologists in torture. Thank you for that work. How do the lessons of this book apply to people's thinking about torture?
Well, thank you, David, for those kind words. A big part of the past decade for me and colleagues has been fighting to eliminate the war on terror, torture, and abuse that we've witnessed, and in particular, and painful to say and acknowledge, psychologists and psychology have played a crucial role in supporting the torture efforts. We know that psychologists were key players in devising programs, in maintaining them, psychological organizations that I think should have been more clearly outspoken against these military policies and protocols were not. And torture, much like the push to war, torture is promoted using the same mind games, and they'll just give one in each of the five categories, just naming them. In vulnerability, we're told it's a dangerous world, as though that means we have to torture. In terms of injustice, we're told we're fighting injustice. That's the mind game, as though that then makes permissible the horrors of waterboarding and other things. In terms of distrust, they're devious and dishonest. So we're told that the people we are mistreating are awful. And in fact, that wouldn't matter. Torture's wrong regardless. But the evidence doesn't support that position anyway. Almost all of the hundreds of people who were locked up at Guantanamo indefinitely had done nothing. They were not terrorists. They had not participated in any terrorism against the United States. They were just swept up off the battlefields of Afghanistan. Often people were paid bounties to bring them in. The fourth torture supporting mind game, superiority, pursuing a higher purpose is the appeal. As though even if you have doubts about what we're doing, understand, that we're on the side of good and morality. And the fifth one is helplessness, we'll all be helpless. The kind of absurd notion that torture is the only thing that can keep us safe. And, I've witnessed this. I've been engaged in fighting against this. Fortunately, persistence has paid off. And, as one example, the American Psychological Association has different policies now than it did a decade ago. Psychologists right now, the APA, does not allow psychologists to work at Guantanamo unless they're working on behalf of a human rights organization or the military personnel. So, but that is a constant battle, and we know that Trump wants to keep Guantanamo open. He wants to expand it. He wants to bring new prisoners there. It's going to be an ongoing struggle.
Well, there are many ongoing struggles that can be aided by this book, which we could go on about for hours, but we're out of time. You're going to have to pick up a copy and read it. It's called Political Mind Games, How the 1% Manipulate Our Understanding of What's Happening, What's Right, and What's Possible, by our guest Roy Idleson. Roy, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Tremendous pleasure, David. Thank you so much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, international opinion largely opposes Donald Trump's current and threatened intervention in Venezuela. But that's not the impression you get from U.S. corporate news media, who appear to be all in with Trump's push for the ouster of democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. As far as we know, these media still firmly oppose any election meddling in this country, especially by Donald Trump. In reality, 75% of the world's countries reject the U.S. anointing of Juan Guaido, whom most Venezuelans hadn't heard of when Trump declared him their leader. And the U.N. has formally condemned U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, which a special rapporteur compared to a medieval siege. Corporate media's fealty to the idea that the United States has the right, if not the duty, to overthrow other countries' leaders to suit our, or some of our, interests doesn't begin and end with Venezuela, but the history of coverage of the country is especially illustrative of what it looks like when elite media works strenuously to maintain the storyline on an official enemy. We've talked about this many times over the years. We're going to revisit some of those conversations today. Venezuela in the U.S. press, today on Counterspin. In March 2006, Counterspin's Peter Hart spoke with Chesa Bodine, co-author of the book The Venezuelan Revolution, 100 Questions, 100 Answers, about a controversial media law from Hugo Chavez that Americans were hearing about, and first, about what surprised him most on his visit to the country.
I was really surprised to see how similar Venezuela is to the United States, how deeply connected Venezuela and the Venezuelan people are with America and American culture. The most popular sport in Venezuela is baseball, not soccer, as in so much of Latin America. Venezuelans eat American food and consume American media and movies, and they really feel a very close connection to American people, despite the fact that our government has failed to build a productive relationship with the Venezuelan government.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, what is the source of the media friction between Chavez and the private media outlets, and what this law is and kind of what has happened as a result of it?
It's obviously a very important law in Venezuela, and it's one of the main things that leads to criticism of the Venezuelan government from international organizations like Human Rights Watch. To back up a second and explain, Venezuela is a country with a very active, very free, and very critical press. Private media stations in the form of radio, TV, and also print media are really the strength and the backbone of the opposition to the Chavez government. The coup against Chavez in 2002, which many people think of as a military coup internationally, Venezuelans call a media coup. The documentary movie, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, illustrates very clearly how the media in Venezuela, the private media, collaborated with the coup plotters, made possible the propagation of a lie that said Chavez had resigned when actually he was being held prisoner. This is just one example, but you know, I would regularly see headlines with a photo of Chavez and a bullseye over his head, the kind of incitement to violence and destabilization of a political process that would simply not be tolerated in countries that have long-standing traditions of free speech. So I think that that's an important context to understand. In that context, you know, again, a lot of Venezuelans look at the media as political parties. They argue, and we talk about this in our book, The Venezuelan Revolution, why it is that Venezuelans who support Chavez argue that the corporate media has actually filled the vacuum left by the failure of the opposition political parties to mount a successful alternative political vision to the Chavez program. So in that context, the private media is often seen as both inciting violence and destabilizing the democracy and really representing the role of opposition political parties. So the Chavez administration has had essentially a three-pronged response to the conflict with the media. And I think two of these prongs I support, one wholeheartedly, one somewhat neutrally. And the third prong I think is more mixed, and I have some criticisms of. The first one, the one that I think is the most important, the one that I most support, is the administration's attempt to empower poor communities and poor people to create alternative community-based media so that there isn't such a dependence on a few corporate-controlled media outlets. The idea being that free speech doesn't just require lack of government interference, but also requires actually a diversity of voices. And so to do that, they've distributed, I think in 2005, over 128 radio transmitters. I'm not super powerful. I'm not going to reach the whole country, but people in barrios, I've seen them. I've been on these radio stations myself. I've watched them broadcast from a rooftop radio station in poor barrios above Caracas. Printing presses have been distributed to these communities so they can have their own community-based newspapers. And they're given training to learn how to use them. So I think that's a really important step, both in terms of the government's ability to respond to the kinds of lies that are printed every day in the corporate media in Venezuela, but also to make sure that it's not just government propaganda that's replacing it. Now, the second kind of major prong of the government response to the media attack has been the kind of foundation of a propaganda arm of the state. And I think this makes sense in the context of what's happening in Venezuela, but it's certainly not something that is as important as the first prong. So they have a Ministry of Information and Communication, which was founded shortly after the 2002 coup. You have, you know, two government TV stations, some of which have excellent programs. It's not all propaganda, but it's some really high-quality international news shows and children's programming as well. But obviously these are pro-government programs for the most part, and Venezuelans are know enough to choose where to watch their news depending on their interests and their perspectives. You also have the international arm of this effort in the form of Telesur, Venezuelan government-driven, though with cooperation from Uruguay, Argentina, Brazil, Cuba, sort of international Latin American Al Jazeera of sorts. It's modeled on Al Jazeera, sort of a people CNN is the way they talk about it. And that just got off the ground within the last year as well. So then those are the two prongs. And I think, again, in context, they make a lot of sense. And the third one, which is a bit more controversial to get to the heart of your question, is this law of social responsibility in television and radio broadcasting. It's a huge law. There's lots of different clauses of it. The one that we hear about the most is the defamation clause. The one that threatens journalists with jail time, essentially if they insult government officials, particularly the president or people who work with the president. And I think that's highly problematic. I think it's important to recognize that to this day, no one is in jail under that law. Amnesty International has no records of political prisoners in Venezuela over the last several years and going back to before that law was passed. But again, I think that this clause is particularly because it's not being enforced. It serves no purpose. It shouldn't be on the books. There's no reason that the Chavez administration should give opposition media more – it shouldn't fan the flames, as it were. And it is, I think, a legitimate criticism to say why are we threatening journalists, even in the context of the role that the corporate media plays as a opposition political party.
Given his demonization, U.S. media consumers can be forgiven for not understanding Chavez's popularity. In 2009, Dan Beaton from the Center for Economic and Policy Research provided some of the basic and uncontested economic information often missing from U.S. news reports.
If you actually look at what the data shows, it shows that there's been considerable economic and social progress in Venezuela. Not over just the last 10 years, but even more importantly, since the opposition in Venezuela ceased their extra-legal activities in 2002 and 2003 that were intended to destabilize and actually overthrow the government there. So it's really more important to look at that time period, since it's not fair to blame the Venezuelan government for the economically harmful actions of the opposition intended, of course, to overthrow it. So in this time period, we've seen that GDP is nearly doubled. It's grown by 94.7% in 5.25 years, which is 13.5% annually. We've seen poverty has been cut by more than half, from 50% of households to 26%. In 2008, we've seen inequality fall very significantly, according to the Gini Index, 41 in 2008 from 48.1 in 2003. Unemployment has fallen by more than half. There's been considerable progress that's not surprising considering the growth and considering that social spending has tripled in this time period.
Well, there's a construction that we come across in Venezuela coverage that's perverse to my view. It's that Chavez is buying popular support with things like access to health care instead of being popularly supported because the government provides these things. You know, it's like people are being bribed by reductions in their poverty level. The line is that he's only able to do this because of oil. So it might be surprising, or it was to me, to hear that most of the growth in the current expansion has not been, in fact, in the oil sector. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that is right. It's actually been in the non-oil sector. It's been in areas like finance and insurance, trade and repair services, transport and storage, and communications. I mean, of course, Chavez does describe his revolution as a socialist revolution. He uses a lot of that kind of rhetoric, but the reality is also that the private sector has done very well under Chavez.
Well, dictator for life, people will have heard, cut extreme poverty by half and also slashed public debt. Those aren't facts that tend to follow Chavez's name around in the U.S. media coverage. And you've talked about how the data that you look at in this report are the data, the kinds of things that are generally looked at. So this means reporters are actually consciously overlooking certain numbers then to arrive at the conclusions that they do.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I'll give you an example. The Economist just published in an article entitled 10 Mostly Wasted Years, which was about, you know, their assessment of the 10 years of the Chavez government. It didn't cite a single economic statistic or social indicator. I don't, you know, want to attribute any motivations to what anybody's doing, but it seems to me almost like they wrote the article before looking at any data, or, you know, possibly could have written it years ago before actually bothering to see what the situation would be like today.
In August 2010, the Venezuela story was about neighbor and U.S. ally Colombia's charge that Venezuela was aiding the Colombian guerrilla group known as the FARC. Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy, talked with Counterspin Steve Rendell about U.S. media's grasp of this regional story.
I've been appalled by the press on this issue, but not surprised, because whenever it comes to Venezuela, there's this bias and this lack of journalistic rigor that it characterizes the articles about the region, about Colombia and Venezuela tensions in particular. In this case, first of all, there was no effort really made to determine whether or not these proofs were really proofs, whether they were true or not. And moreover, it's very difficult to know exactly what these proofs were proving. And there was no real analysis of what does it mean if there's supposedly a ELN leader drinking a beer on a Venezuelan beach. What does that really prove? And yet, instead of analyzing these things or taking it at least in a neutral stance, the Washington Post editorial ended up jumping directly to the conclusion that Chavez is the head of a terrorist alliance. There's no substantiation to that, and it's an extremely inflammatory statement. So what we've seen is a progression from unsubstantiated and unanalyzed so-called evidence going straight toward these blanket statements that are accepted not only as consensus opinions, but also as news itself. And on the other hand, we do not see the mainstream press reporting on peace efforts. Immediately after this happened, the FARC, which are the main guerrilla group in Colombia, came out with a statement calling for a political solution. The UNASUR and other countries in the region stated that they were going to be working toward a peace accord, which President Uribe rejected, within the region that would finally put an end to the conflict in Colombia. Yet we do not receive the kind of information that there are initiatives toward peace talks in Colombia, again, because there's this line coming out of Washington and echoed by the mainstream press that is promoting a military so-called solution to the conflict.
Hugo Chavez died in 2013, but that didn't mean U.S. media didn't have him to kick around anymore. We spoke with Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
So what is it about him that they really hated so much? I think he criticized the United States. He didn't criticize the people of the United States, of course, but he criticized U.S. foreign policy very strongly, and He wanted to be independent, and he wanted South America independent, and he won that battle. That was really his unforgivable sin. If you look at the battle over the last 14 years since Chavez was in office, there's no doubt that the United States lost most of its influence in South America and in Latin America, too, to a certain extent, the whole region. And that's huge. It's a huge change, and he had a huge role in it. And that, I think, was kind of unforgivable for a lot of people. Most of the media really supports the U.S. having a lot of power in the world, whether it's used for good or evil.
There are few that say that Venezuela is free of problems, but it seems clear sometimes that the criticisms we're hearing really aren't about those. And sometimes there's a kind of a crass kind of realpolitik, as when NBC's Brian Williams says, all this matters a lot to the U.S. since Venezuela sits on top of a lot of oil, and that's how this now gets interesting for the United States. I mean, I suppose in some ways it might improve coverage if that understanding of U.S. interests as being self-interested, you know, and not so much about democracy or human rights. I mean, maybe if that perspective informed coverage generally, it would make it make more sense.
Well, I think it was Alan Greenspan who caused a little bit of a stir by saying the United States would never have invaded Iraq if it wasn't for the oil. It's not so much the oil itself, because as you can see, the government of Venezuela has always continued to sell the oil to the United States. It's really that any country with that much oil, and it's the largest reserves in the world, is going to have an influence. It's going to be independent. It's going to have its own foreign policy if it wants to. And that's the real problem for Washington. They don't like countries to have regional influence if they can't control them. And obviously, if you look at our wars, Iraq, the threatened war with Iran, I mean, these are, you know, one was a dictatorship, one is more of a theocracy. But Venezuela is a democracy, but it really doesn't matter. If you have oil and you're not doing what Washington wants, you're bound to run into some kind of trouble. And I think that's the thing. Chavez could have been the most perfect diplomatic politician and done everything right in a diplomatic sense, and he would have been treated the same way by the U.S. State Department.
It's hard to really see what's happening on the ground in Venezuela when U.S. media cover protests selectively and use the term civil society as a synonym for the country's elites. Venezuelan historian and Pomona College professor Miguel Tinker Salas joined Counterspin from Venezuela in March 2014 as opposition demonstrations were winding down. Steve Rendell had a simple question.
How do you see the makeup of the opposition?
The reality is that we're not facing a national rebellion. Most of the opposition has been centered in 18 different municipalities in states like Táchira, Mérida, some in Carabobo, and in eastern part of Caracas. I'm in western Caracas, and I've walked the entire city streets, and it's calm and peaceful. So that these are pockets of resistance in neighborhoods, because the interesting phenomena here is what the protesters did was they barricaded themselves in behind their own neighborhoods. It was an odd form of protest because essentially they barricaded upper and middle class neighborhoods and essentially prevented commerce and transfer of people and daily activity, as if that was going to precipitate a counter-revolution against the government of Nicolás Maduro. That hasn't happened.
So what is it that the protesters really want?
Well, they want to overthrow the government. I mean, the problem with the protesters is that there's been a democratic process in this country for the last 15 years. The pro-government forces and the popular forces and the left coalition has won 18 out of 19 elections. And given the electoral cycle this year, it's interesting, there are no elections this year. So they're uncomfortable with democracy. In December of 2013, the government actually won 70% of the municipalities. So the opposition, in many ways, is uncomfortable with democracy. They don't want to see the process unfold, and they've instead decided to use real problems the country has. No doubt about it, 56% inflation, crime, shortages of food, in many parts because of hoarding, but also because of contraband trade. Over 30% of Venezuela's products are actually taken out as contraband to Colombia, which is a billion-dollar industry through the state of Táchira and Zulia. So they're real demands, but they've taken and manipulated those demands, and their aim has been to oust a democratically elected government. And that has not happened. And the business sector recognizes it because they've joined the government in peace negotiations and dialogues and trying to find solutions to the economic problems. But the political opposition faces a Tea Party scenario where there's a faction within the right conservative forces that doesn't want to negotiate with the government, so that in essence, to be a leader of the opposition, you have to outright the more radical elements in your own organization. They want to be able to be the leaders of the opposition, but they actually have a problem, because if they want to win over the larger population, they can't do that with the obstinate position that they've taken. So they find themselves in a contradiction, and what these protests have really exposed is the fact that there are fundamental differences over democracy within the opposition.
Well, we've had just a torrent of pro-opposition propaganda in the U.S., all cheering for the elites to prevail over a democratic government largely elected by the poor. Now that demonstrations are ramping down, does this mean that democracy won? Where do you see things going?
I think that part of this whole strategy has been precisely the fact that there was an active campaign done internationally to actually create conditions within the media and elsewhere and create the popular perception that there was a national chaos, a national revolt, that the masses were protesting, when in fact it's the opposite. A Colombian commentator said, Venezuela is an odd country. It's the only country where the rich protest and the poor celebrate, which gives you insight into what's going on here. And even the New York Times has had to admit that most of the protests are relegated to rich and upper-class neighborhoods. But it's clear that Venezuela's image internationally has been part of that campaign to try to isolate, to tarnish it, and to create conditions that make it seem like the country is either on a Ukraine-like crisis or a Syrian-style civil war, which is nothing further from the truth.
In early 2015, the Obama White House declared Venezuela a threat to the United States' national security, paving the way for debilitating economic sanctions. Counterspin spoke about Venezuela's real threat to U.S. power with activist and author Alfredo Lopez of May 1st, People Link.
First of all, the United States doesn't like progressive governments and never has in that region. The United States, for foreign policy purposes, still considers Latin America to be its backyard. Given that fact, you need to do your gardening according to the United States design. And when you put together a society that challenges the fundamental precepts of American capitalist society, the government of the United States declares you an enemy. I mean, that's one reason. Now, a number of governments do that right now in Latin America, Janine. But Venezuela is a very special case. It is a highly developed country. It is a cosmopolitan country, several highly developed cities, a very advanced education system. And so that is a problem for the United States because of the possibility of Venezuela taking leadership, as it already has in Latin America, and challenging the American leadership. It also has the option of developing a full-fledged progressive and possibly socialist society because of the diversity of its capabilities, because of its development. And then the third thing is oil. Venezuela is one of the major petroleum producers in the world. United States is still oil dependent. The world is still petroleum dependent. And that means Venezuela has a lot of clout within the traditional capitalist markets. So it's a real problem for the United States to have a government that's denouncing it as an imperialist force.
Well, a Miami Herald headline said that Maduro was looking to fight U.S. imperialism, which it put in quotation marks, both because he had used the phrase, but also to indicate that that's an absurd concept. Listeners may have heard, I know it aired on Democracy Now!, the recent press conference in which State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said any accusations that the U.S. was supporting destabilization or coup efforts in Venezuela were ludicrous. And Psaki said that the U.S., as a matter of longstanding policy, does not support political transitions by non-constitutional means, which made at least one reporter present say, whoa, you know, whoa there. But one can't imagine a person, as you're just saying, a person who reads the news, you know, watches the news, and still has no awareness of the U.S.'s recent role in some non-constitutional transitions.
Media experts like Jen Psaki, who's a master of media manipulation, can actually get away with saying stuff like that with the collaboration of a lot of this mainstream media. The United States foreign policy particularly in Latin America, but in many other parts of the world, for the last 20 to 30 years, has been consistent destabilization of other governments. That's the policy. When it feels that another government is problematic or hostile to U.S. interests, it seeks to destabilize them.
The U.S. media give Venezuela and Hugo Chavez and now Maduro and the whole Bolivarian project such official enemy treatment that it's hard not to laugh. But one thing that that does is leave little to no room for thoughtful criticism, you know, to acknowledge the problems that for sure do exist in Venezuela. Where can we have that conversation?
That is a difficult conversation to have because of U.S. attack.
Right.
And that is, you're absolutely right, that is perhaps the major victim of all of this. Support for the Venezuelan Bolivarian Project, as you call it, Janine, and I am certainly, and have always been a supporter of it, doesn't mean a totally blind or uncritical kind of support. Bolivarian Revolutionary Government has made, in my opinion, several very, very key strategic errors. It is difficult for us to imagine a just world, but if we could, in a just world, what would be the reaction to this? The reaction to a government that's democratically elected, that has a record of having improved a country in a fundamental way, improvements that are more vast than any other country in recent history. The improvements of life in Venezuela for poor and lower-income working-class people are absolutely stunning. They're almost miraculous. So what do we do in a just world? Well, a just world gets together with them and says, look, you're having problems here with your economy. We're going to support you with that. You guys really need to talk about this internally, and you need to have a discussion about what you're going to do. And we want to join that discussion. That's the world's reaction, is to support the discussion, just like a family, just like friends. If one of your friends is having problems and, you know, you feel that they, he or she should be changing, you don't walk in with a gun and blow their head off. You have a conversation with them. You try to support them as best you can.
That was Alfredo Lopez, and before him, Miguel Tinker Salas, Mark Weisbrot, Laura Carlson, Dan Beaton, and Chesa Bodine. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. More dangerous warming methane is pouring into the atmosphere. Later in this hour, expert Ewan Nisbet tells us where it is coming from, and no, not from the Arctic. First, the visionary scientist Thomas Crowther from ETH Zurich on carbon, warming, the Arctic, and a plan to plant a trillion trees to help stabilize the climate. Yes, we can, and the kids have already started. There is far more carbon stored in the soil of this planet than in its atmosphere. If soil organisms release that as carbon dioxide faster and faster as the climate warms, we may not be able to stop it. Or can we? Our guest, Dr. Thomas Crowther, is an assistant professor of global ecosystem ecology at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. He directs the Crowther Lab. Thomas is also a Marie Curie Fellow at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. Our last interview on Radio EcoShock was in December 2016, and he's been busy since. If you care about life, this is a must-listen guest.
Radio EcoShock.
Thomas Crowther, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, Thomas, I realize you have some planet-scale solutions to help stave off the worst of climate change, but first let me ask about carbon, warming, and the Arctic. Is the Earth losing more carbon from the soil into the atmosphere?
It's a very good and important question. Essentially, there's an ongoing debate among scientists about whether the Earth's surface is going to continue to absorb some of the human emissions that we've been producing over the last 100 years. And a growing body of evidence is suggesting that that process is stopping in plants, and in fact, the soils might in fact be becoming a source of carbon. As we warm the planet, the activity of microorganisms in the soil starts to speed up, and this could actually increase losses of carbon into the atmosphere, which could accelerate the rate of climate change.
Well, you've brought up another key question, which is, does global warming impact the rate or amount of carbon loss from the soil?
This is ultimately one of the biggest questions of ecosystem ecologists. And I think, at least in our lab, we're taking a very sort of global approach, a holistic global approach to consider the soils and the plants. And it suggests that when you take all of these ecosystems in combination, it does suggest that, yeah, we're starting to get accelerated losses of carbon into the atmosphere.
At the 2019 annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, it was in Washington this February, you presented a chart that shows where carbon is buried under the soil. And I found it very surprising to see what part of the Earth has the biggest depository of carbon buried down there. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Essentially, we've always focused on the tropics for much of our climate change research, because these are the areas where there's huge trees and huge carbon storage in the forest. But what we actually find when we look below the surface is actually that the vast, vast majority of the world's carbon is actually stored in the high-latitude parts of the world, like the Arctic and subarctic regions. And these store a huge amount of carbon for a very simple reason. It's cold up there, and those cold conditions slow down the activity of the microorganisms in the soil. And when their activity is slowed down, they don't respire as much. And that slowed down respiration means that when carbon goes in, it stays in there for a long, long time, thousands of years, and it builds up to a huge extent. And that carbon storage in those soils is one of the biggest and most important stocks of carbon on our planet.
But it's still surprising because so little vegetation grows up there at this time, compared to something like the Amazon, which is just a carbon storehouse. How could it all be up in the Arctic like that?
It's a very good question. It's all about the balance between these two very simple processes. Photosynthesis is the uptake of carbon by plants, and respiration is the release of carbon back into the atmosphere. And what we find is actually that respiration is a lot more temperature sensitive than photosynthesis. And what that means is when it's warm, like in the tropics, photosynthesis is huge and plants are taking up loads and loads of carbon. But respiration is even higher. So when the leaves fall and when that plant carbon goes into the soil, the activity of those microorganisms in the soil is so high that they just spew the carbon back into the atmosphere in most parts of the tropics. That I would put a caveat that that doesn't happen in wetlands, which are very anaerobic, and so that you can build up a lot of soil carbon there. But in most of the tropics, you see this huge loss of carbon into the atmosphere from the soils. In contrast, when we go down into the cold areas, photosynthesis is very low. As you said, plants are tiny, they're taking up a small amount of carbon, but respiration is even lower. So even though a very small drip of carbon is coming into those ecosystems, it's not leaving because the microorganisms in the soil are so cold and they're so slow that that carbon just stays there for thousands of years and builds up gradually over time.
Is there enough carbon held now in the Arctic and subarctic to actually affect our future climate if it starts to become released at a greater rate?
I would stress with all urgency that yes, the answer is overwhelmingly yes. The amount of carbon stored in those high latitudes is huge, many times more than all of the plant vegetation in total. And if we're going to start warming our planet to an extent that those microorganisms start respiring at a faster and faster rate, then those carbon, those huge carbon stocks become very, very vulnerable. So managing those ecosystems and trying to keep temperatures cool, keep plants on those soils, managing them effectively, reducing tillage and damage can be maybe one of our most effective strategies to minimize the impact of climate change.
In an interview with David Gadsden, you said there are probably more animals in the Arctic than in the tropics. Now, that's just preposterous. How could that be?
Yeah, it sounds crazy, but our initial suggestions are pointing in that direction. I should stress that the exact information on this topic will be has just been accepted for publication, and I'll be able to give you the exact details on that information when it comes out in the journal. But we can point towards suggesting that, yes, in fact, most of the world's animals exist below the soil in the form of these tiny little nematode worms. Almost four out of every five animals on the planet is a nematode worm. And these are some of the microorganisms that exist in those huge soil carbon stocks in the high latitude regions. And remember, these go all the way from the Arctic, you know, down to like the UK, down to halfway through North America. This is the whole Arctic and subarctic area. And these are teeming with organisms. And in fact, when we go further down into the tropics, the soil carbon storage is so small there, it's not enough to support a huge amount of those organisms. So it may in fact be the case that, yes, those high latitude areas are where most of the world's life is.
And some of this knowledge comes from the first global map of life under the soil developed by your lab?
That's it, yeah. So our lab's trying to sort of do science with a slightly different approach. Rather than focusing purely on satellites, which have been transformative in our understanding of, you know, the global scale ecosystems, what we do now is we collect thousands and thousands and thousands of data points, which can allow us to see below the canopy surface. So we can see information about the trees and also about the soil organisms. And when we use artificial intelligence and machine learning, we can really get a good picture of the entire global ecosystem below that surface.
Thomas Crowther, tell us about the Global Soil Biodiversity Initiative. What is that?
Okay, so this is an initiative that was set up several years ago by a lady called Diana Wall, who's a fantastic soil ecologist in the U.S., and she wanted ultimately to connect as many soil ecologists around the world as possible for one simple reason. We've got an amazing idea about the global distribution of plants, but almost no understanding about the global understanding of these below-ground organisms that are so critical for understanding our biosphere and biogeochemistry and the climate and soil fertility. And by connecting those people, she was hoping that we might ultimately be able to combine forces and bring all of our ideas together. Now, what we've done in our lab is rather than just combining the people, we've used that network of people to combine as much data as we can. And so now we're launching our Global Soil Biodiversity Initiative data set, which essentially has a lot of the information that's been collected by those thousands of people around the world to generate that global perspective of the below-ground world that's going to change our understanding of biogeochemistry.
And we know the Arctic is warming faster than pretty well anywhere on the planet. Now, I'm trying to picture what happens in that Arctic and subarctic soil. Does that wake up a lot more life? Does it start that little factory that releases carbon and methane?
That's exactly the fear, yes. As you know, those huge carbon stores only happen there because it's cold. When we alleviate that cold, when we warm the temperatures, those organisms start to speed up their activity, and that speeding up means respiratory losses of carbon into the atmosphere. And in fact, last year we showed that we can actually quantify these losses at a global scale, and we approximate that that's at the moment in the order of about 1.5 gigatons of carbon per year. So by 2050, we're looking at an extra 12 to 17% acceleration of climate change. And in fact, it's equivalent to having another industrialized country the size of the United States on the planet, really.
And that's by 2050.
Exactly.
Wow.
No, I mean, this is an annual loss. The 1.5 gigatons is every other year.
So if we heat up, say, 3 or 4 degrees above pre-industrial by the end of the century, which more scientists are starting to suggest here on Radio EcoShock, what does that do to the kind of carbon loss calculations and the extra warming coming out of that new carbon into the atmosphere?
From our understanding that we have at the moment, it suggests that that's only going to speed up those losses to a great extent. And given the huge, huge amounts of carbon in those high latitude soils, I don't think it's going to be slowing down anytime soon, unfortunately, unless humans intervene, I should say.
Yes. Okay. Well, that sounds like a dangerous positive feedback loop, though, because, I mean, as these organisms start releasing more carbon, the carbon becomes greenhouse gases, which warms up the ground down below more and then more activity. That could be a dangerous chain.
Yeah, that's exactly the concern. Yes. Once we start off biological feedbacks like this, they then accentuate themselves. It's like a rolling cycle, you know, the soil carbon loss increases, causing more warming, which causes the soil carbon loss to increase more, which causes more warming. And yeah, the concern is that these things might accelerate to a great extent.
And because it's a natural system, we can't just pass a law or make regulations to make it stop.
Quite exactly, yeah. So what we really need is to be proactive and get moving now to be able to minimize those increases in temperature as early as we can so that we can prevent setting off these huge global scale feedbacks.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
You are listening to Dr. Thomas Crowe, the Assistant Professor of Global Ecosystem Ecology at ETH Zurich. This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. Our second adventure, Thomas, goes into your projects, and it starts by asking how many trees there are on Earth. It sounds like maybe a simple question or maybe an impossible question. In fact, it seemed impossible before you tackled it. What did you find, and how did you do it?
It is a fascinating question, because I started this a few years ago, and I was connected by a friend who worked for an organization called Plant for the Planet, and they were running the UN's Billion Tree Campaign. They were planning to plant a billion trees to offset climate change, capture loads of carbon from the trees. But they didn't know how many trees there were to start with. And in fact, there was a previous estimate of about 400 billion trees on the planet. So that's the information they used to make those targets. But after a little bit of back-of-the-envelope calculations, we realized that that number was actually way off. And in fact, no one had done a really robust census of the world's trees. And by doing so, by collecting, again, data from thousands and thousands, in fact, millions of locations around the world, we could get a really good picture on how the numbers of trees vary across the globe. And in fact, that showed us that the Earth stores just over 3 trillion trees.
Wow. You're talking about almost like stars in the sky, 3 trillion. That's quite interesting. Are we losing or gaining trees on this planet?
It's interesting you should make the analogy with stars in the sky, because literally, there are more trees on our planet than there are stars in our galaxy, which is quite an incredible feat. But the concern is ultimately that good evidence suggests that we are, in fact, losing trees. Now, Plenty of research suggests that, in fact, in many parts of the world, we're seeing greening. So satellites are picking up more and more and more greening of certain ecosystems. And that's often in the high-latitude parts of the world where forests didn't previously exist. As we warm the planet, trees sort of encroach into those ecosystems. But what we're finding is that the small amount of extra trees, tiny extra trees that we're getting in those high-latitude areas is unfortunately not enough to offset the huge amount of losses that we see in the low-latitude, you know, tropical areas as a result of deforestation and land use change.
Well, just now we talked about investigating life in the soil. How does that relate to the life of forests?
These things are so intrinsically linked. Absolutely, a healthy soil is critical if we're going to be able to build a healthy forest. And both of them are undoubtedly necessary for each other. It's funny, as a scientist who works both on soil and vegetation, I often get questions about one topic or the other. And in fact, it's an incredibly connected, holistic system. And having that holistic approach is definitely the best strategy for management in both directions. So soil people ask me, how do we manage our soils? And I say, generally, you know, there's different strategies around the world, but one of the best strategies is you can always say increasing plant cover is usually a good thing and minimizing disturbance is a good thing. The same questions are asked to me of forest people, and I say improve the soils, support the soils, then the trees can be supported. So it's they really healthy soils require healthy vegetation and vice versa.
And you claim to have identified long-disappeared forests. How could you do that?
I should state that that's not parts of the world that weren't previously known to man. What we've done is instead begin to understand the full scale of the world's forests. So while satellites could say, okay, this is an area of trees, they vastly underestimated how many trees existed in those areas and how many new trees could be supported in different parts of the world. So it's really not so much identifying new forests as identifying the scale of our forests. And that transforms our understanding of how we manage them in the fight against climate change.
And you claim we could grow another 1.2 trillion new trees. Where could these be planted, and do we have to give up croplands or city space to do it?
No, that is a very good point. We evaluated where on the planet trees could exist using the same sort of approach that we did to evaluate where they do exist. And you're right, we found that, in fact, outside of the world's forests, and outside of the world's urban areas and outside of the world's agricultural areas where they are today, there's room for an additional 1.2 trillion new trees. And as a result of that kind of information, the UN's Billion Tree Campaign has now been scaled up to the Trillion Tree Campaign. And the exciting thing is I was concerned about giving them this information because I thought it might undermine their efforts. But instead, with the new updated scientific information, they took this in such a positive light. And, instead of moping around, they've stepped up their efforts and they know their new targets. And already in the last couple of years, they've restored 17 billion new trees, proving that global scale restoration is undoubtedly possible.
Tell us about the Plant for the Planet initiative.
This is a group of essentially children advocates. It's a youth-led organization with 70,000 members all across the world, going around and talking to people and promoting global forest restoration and its potential to offset climate change. And the beauty of it is they don't just do that with the most effective, up-to-date scientific information, but it's children. And they're inspiring people across the globe to really get involved in tree planting. And one of their mottos that I really like is the simple statement of stop talking and start planting. And I find myself eternally embroiled in debates about whether tree restoration is the most important or cutting carbon emissions are the most important. And these debates are not useful. Essentially, we are all in agreement that we must minimize atmospheric carbon. Global forest restoration is undoubtedly one of the best strategies we have for doing that. So they just go out there and act. And if people want to get involved in that mission, they are incredibly keen for others to get on board, and they're growing at a great rate.
Could you give us one example of a place where we could install a new forest?
Literally everywhere across the globe, there are forests that could be restored. Now, where our science is trying to focus on is trying to understand which parts of the world are the most important for them to be able to allocate those resources. So in some parts of the world, you know, like the high-latitude boreal forests, planting a forest can actually warm the planet slightly. Of course, it's still better for biodiversity and all the services they provide, But there can be a warming effect because whereas those ecosystems were previously covered in snow, now trees would actually absorb a lot of the sun's light and have a slight warming impact. Whereas often in the low latitudes, in the tropical forests, as you mentioned, those huge carbon storage, carbon stocks in the vegetation have the potential to offset a huge amount of anthropogenic emissions. So we can start to target which are the best locations for them to be able to prioritize their restoration.
Well, suppose we mount a gigantic worldwide program to plant a trillion new trees with the UN, with the kids, with local citizen groups, with some of my listeners, and we do it in part to save the climate. Could it help save the climate?
Our research is providing more and more and more evidence that not only is such a global initiative possible, but it undoubtedly could have a massive impact on the climate. Unfortunately, I'm not able to give you the exact numbers because the paper that we've recently completed is currently in review in a high-impact journal. But when that paper is finally completed, we'll be able to give the exact numbers on how much carbon could potentially be stored in those forests. And what I can confirm is that that value places global forest restoration way above all of the other existing climate change solutions listed. So this simple act of just connecting with the land and planting a few trees, if we all engaged in it, it undoubtedly has the potential to offset a massive chunk of anthropogenic emissions.
Well, lately news came out that the boreal forest stretching across the northern lands has become a net source of carbon instead of the carbon sink we assumed. And I think part of that may have to do with wildfires. I'm not sure. Does that match your findings?
It does, in fact, and that's partly because of wildfires and increased incidence of wildfires, but also because although we are seeing increased growth of trees, as I mentioned earlier, as the climate warms, the soil below those trees is getting warmer and the microorganisms are starting to respire more rapidly. And so even though trees are taking up more carbon, the soils are actually emitting even more than the trees are taking up. And again, that's that positive climate change feedback that could really accelerate climate change. It's a big concern.
Environmentalists have long claimed that replanting monocultures, like a single commercial tree species after logging, is the wrong way to go. Thomas Crowther, do you have the science now to prove that's true?
We undoubtedly do. Once again, with this global scale approach, we can see past the idiosyncrasy of individual site analyses. So there have been lots of studies saying, you know, a more diverse forest is better or a monoculture is better in different parts of the world. But by taking data from every single, all these millions of locations around the world, we can get a global unifying perspective. And what we find is consistently at a global scale, more species is always better than fewer species. We, in fact, did a back-of-the-envelope scaling in one of our recent papers to show that the global forests are worth just over $600 billion to the timber market and the pulp and paper industry and forestry. If we were to instead convert the world's forests to a monoculture of the most productive forests, those forests, even with the same number of trees in those forests, if it was just a monoculture, would lose almost $300 billion just to the timber market. It's a massive difference. And so undoubtedly, diversity of species is always better.
So monoculture is just it's a bad business decision.
Undoubtedly. It's a bad business decision. And for the ecology of these ecosystems, it's a devastating one because we know that diversity provides such services to support all other parts of life, which also then supports human life. They capture less carbon, so the monocultures aren't as good at offsetting climate change. So in almost all circumstances, diversity is much better than a monoculture.
And we talked about the soil initiative. What is the Global Forest Biodiversity Initiative?
So this is a huge network of data collection that we've started in our lab, very similar to the Soil Biodiversity Initiative data set, where instead of relying on satellites alone, we can now connect all the thousands of foresters around the world who are generating incredibly good and detailed information on the ground. They've been in those forests, they've measured those trees, they've evaluated the health of those ecosystems. And by sending in all of that data, we can combine all that information at a global scale. Then using machine learning and artificial intelligence, again, we can get that really good predictive understanding of the structure of forests that's built from bottom-up data rather than satellites.
When I watch a couple of your YouTube video presentations, I'm stunned by the brand new maps of where things grow on our planet or life we've never seen hidden underground. And I expect experts to use GIS or geographic information systems to communicate complex results so we can all understand them. But it seems to me you've gone another step. You use those maps as tools of discovery to find new things. Is that true?
That's exactly true. By combining these huge data sets of information, not only do we reveal where ecosystems can store more carbon or less carbon or more biodiversity, but we also just learn fundamental new things about the planet that we couldn't have known from taking a local scale approach, like how many trees exist on the planet or the fact that there's more carbon in the high latitudes than the low latitudes. And every time we combine this global scale information, we get completely new insights into our biosphere. And it's only with that kind of understanding that we can be really effective in our fight against climate change.
Do you see a time coming when the public will be able to use your interactive maps to zoom into our own home regions to see what grows or what could grow where we live?
Definitely. That time is very soon. With geographic information systems, and in fact, Google Earth Engine is an incredibly useful tool that can be used to take those maps and place them onto systems that can be easily used by people at home. And in fact, we're starting to do that now. So all of our maps, as soon as they're published, they're going to be uploaded and available. So you can click onto your Google Maps and you can actually zoom around the world and go, how many trees are there here? How many trees could there be here in the absence of humans? And how much carbon could they support? And the nice thing is, you know, I've been doing it myself in the last couple of days. The first thing you do is you zoom in on your home and you go, oh, how many trees should there be here? Whoa, there should be loads. Okay, cool. This place can support a lot of forest. And just that spatial perspective, I hope it's going to inspire people to really get engaged and feel connected to the planet.
Thomas Crowther, I last talked with you in December 2016 after you published your paper quantifying global soil carbon losses in response to warming, and that was in the journal Nature. Do you have any new surprises that have developed from your research since then?
I have to say that every time we get one of these global perspectives, it's a bit of a new surprise. At the moment, we have four papers that are currently under review that are really going to transform our understanding of the distribution of biodiversity and carbon storage in the biosphere. But until they come out, I can't quite give you the exact numbers. So hopefully in the very near future, I'll be able to provide all of that information to you, and hopefully people can use it to make effective climate change decisions.
Well, I'll be watching my Science Alert service, and then I can pass it on to listeners when your papers come out. And as a final question, Thomas, you've developed some answers about the world we didn't have before, and I'd love to ask you what it is that sparks this blast of science in your head, but I also suspect maybe that's one of the few things you don't know for sure. Your thoughts?
I think you may well be right. I've always been inspired by diversity. Anyone who says there's no magic in the world, I just challenge them to look outside the window and look at the immense biodiversity that scientists have no meaningful explanation for. We don't know how life arose, let alone is maintained. And this has always just inspired me. But I think the recent developments in our research are partially due to that inspiration by biodiversity, but also a lot of luck. We've come here, well, I'm starting to do this at a time when data is available. We can finally start to get this global scale perspective. And so every new piece of information seems to unlock new pieces of information. And I think it's just an incredibly exciting time to be involved in this.
I'll let you go now. Thomas, thank you for your work and for sharing it with us on Radio EcoShock.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Great to chat to you.
From ETH Zurich in Switzerland, we spoke with Dr. Thomas Crowther. Find links to the science we discussed, a couple of videos with his amazing computer-driven maps, and the links to the Crowther Lab in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Next up, some surprises from the scientist who first warned us about Arctic methane, where it's coming from now, and why this little publicized gas could derail the Paris Agreement aimed at saving a livable climate.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Levels of the strong warming gas methane are again rising in the atmosphere. A new study warns the trend could derail plans made at Paris to contain climate change if things continue. Is the new surge of methane coming from the Arctic? Is it from fracking and natural gas pipelines? Guess again. Our next guest investigated the new mystery methane surge. Professor Ewan Nisbet is a professor of earth sciences at the Royal Holloway, University of London. On February 5, 2019, the AGU published the paper Very Strong Atmospheric Methane Growth in the 4 years 2014-2017, Implications for the Paris Agreement. The lead author is Ewan Nisbet. Dr. Nisbet, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
You too. Now, for the public, global warming is about carbon dioxide. And for years, experts said methane doesn't really matter because it's a short-lived gas. What do you say?
Well, lots of things are important. There's apples and oranges. Methane is actually very important indeed. You can rate it various different ways because it depends on the timescale, but it's nearly half as important, depending on how you count it, maybe in some countings more than half as important as CO2. The other thing is, in some ways, you can actually get at methane much more easily rather than changing the entire world economy, which we have to do for CO2, which we have to do. We need to do everything on CO2, but we mustn't forget the Cinderella gas, which is methane. And there's another one also, N2O, plus some others. So the other gases are also very, very, very important.
And for background, what was the level of methane in the atmosphere before the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s?
Well, first of all, don't really talk about levels, not a bucket of water. The amount, or it's called methane burden, or in chemistry we talk about the mole fraction. It's now around about, if you have 1 billion liters of air, you'll have around about 1,900 of those will be methane. Before the Industrial Revolution, 1,000 or below, and way, way back in the Ice Ages, it would be 300-400s. So we've pushed it up a very long way, proportionately much further than CO2.
And when I started this radio program in 2006, scientists told us methane, the burden in the atmosphere, was either paused or growing very slowly. When did the new growth start?
Okay, well, I'll wind you back a bit. For the last 200 years, it's been going up. And we know, because of the types of carbon in it, that it's been fossil fuels driving it up. And especially in the 1980s, when it was going up like crazy, particularly when the Russians were putting in their very large gas industry. And it looked as if it was equilibrating around about 2000. And from 2000 to 2006, it was going up and down, but basically fairly stable. We thought that the sources equaled the sinks. And so although methane was very, very high, it's like you're driving down the highway at 180 miles an hour, but you're not actually accelerating anymore. And then in 2007, something very strange happened, and methane started growing again pretty strongly. And then in 2014, it just went back to the growth rates of back in the 1980s. But the difference is the types of carbon-12, carbon-13 ratio in it was indicating that it wasn't necessarily fossil fuels that are doing this. It was something else. It was biological processes.
Well, let's get to a key question. How can scientists measure methane in the atmosphere and then know the source of it?
It's tough. The answer is no, we don't. What we do, particularly the American NOAA network, we have a network of stations around the world where there are a few instruments that record all the time, but people collect flasks of air. And so we're tracking CO2 and methane and the other gases from these flasks, particularly the American network. We also have a UK network that we run, and there are other ones in New Zealand. And Canada's got a very good network across Canada, Environment Canada. So that's telling you where it's growing. And so you'll see that it's growing faster, say, in the tropics than the Arctic, things like that. But then also we analyze the methane. Methane is CH4. And carbon comes in carbon-12 and carbon-13, and there's also radioactive carbon-14. And if you analyze those different types, the methane from geological sources and also from fires, so from coal and gas and from fires, that tends to be richer in carbon-13, relatively richer, whereas methane that comes from a swamp or a wetland or a landfill or a sewage plant or a cow, that tends to be somewhat richer in carbon-12. So if you analyze what's happening to the carbon-12-13 ratio, you can then figure out who's actually driving the increase and also, of course, what the proportions are of the various gas, various sources.
And your team recently returned from Africa with new samples. Tell us about that expedition.
Well, there's back history here. Very long ago in the 1980s, I worked in Saskatoon for a long time. My family's half from the prairies. And I was the one who actually suggested that methane in the Arctic was rising because of methane hydrates. It was long ago. And we've been watching the Arctic and doing a lot of work in the Arctic. But the bulk of the rise, apart from 2007, in the last 10 years, has been led from the tropics. Something was happening in the tropics we didn't understand. We have a wonderful aircraft that we have been flying around in the Arctic. It's the UK Atmospheric Research Aircraft. And so we've been flying that over African wetlands in collaboration with the Ugandan Meteorological Authority and also the Zambian Ministry of Mines and Geological Survey in Zambia, looking at these very big wetlands in Central Africa, because we think that a lot of the growth is happening in the tropics, in the wet tropics, and that may be coming from wetlands or it may be coming from cows or some other process. A cow is essentially a walking wetland. In terms of biology, it's pretty much the same. And we're trying to figure out just how much is coming off there. We're also working, ironically, in conjunction with the British Antarctic Survey, who have aircraft that, when they fly north up to service them in Calgary, the Twin Otters, they're going to be stopping in Bolivia and working with the physics department in La Paz to try to look at Bolivian emissions and emissions in the wetlands of South America. So we're trying to figure out what's actually happening in the tropics with the methane budget. And there's very little work on it so far.
Well, as you say, we've heard so much about methane from the Arctic and from natural gas systems. Most of us have never seen a tropical peat bog, and we have no idea how they operate. Can you describe the landscape that is releasing more methane?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty complex. I've done huge amounts of work in the Arctic, and Arctic bogs are active for about sort of 6-8 weeks in the summer when they get hot. In the tropics, the intertropical convergence zone, which is also the monsoon in Asia, it sweeps north and south. Right now it's down in Zambia, and then it sweeps back up to north of Nigeria, and it'll be up there in July, August, later on in the year. And crosses, of course, place the equatorial parts twice, like Uganda. So Uganda's pretty wet, and Zambia's got these enormous wetlands. And also around there, lots of cows, and there's lots of biomass burning as well, people burning fires and crop and so on. And all of these processes are making methane. Anytime you get a swamp, you get rotting vegetation, it becomes anaerobic. And then you get microbes, they're called archaea, methanogenic archaea. They make methane, the sort of bottom end of the breakdown stage. And you also get pretty much the same thing going on inside a cow's tummy. And out of that comes this gas methane. A lot of it, as it comes up through the water or wherever it is, gets reoxidized by bacteria called methanotrophs. So that just gets turned into CO2. But a lot of it gets into the air. And, for example, in our flights recently, they were flying over Lake Bangweulu, which is a big lake in Zambia. It's actually where David Livingstone died, and means where the water sky meets the sky. It's wonderful, wonderful photos. And they found a huge plume of methane coming off that, the Bangweulu wetlands. They're just pouring out methane.
Do we have any idea what would stimulate more methane coming from the tropics starting around 2007?
Climate change, this looks like the warming feeding the warming. I've got to be careful because there are other explanations too. But the tropics are getting more active. They're getting wetter, warmer, and expanding. The rainfall tropics, the meteorological tropics. You know, the line around the Earth stays pretty much the same. But the belt of rainfall that moves north and south is getting warmer and wetter and stronger. And if you add an awful lot of water on a bit of flat ground, you're going to get a big lot of wetland and lots of, in Africa, it's papyrus swamps. And that's something called a C4 plant. It grows like crazy. If you've ever seen paper comes from papyrus, originally. And these are very, very productive wetlands. And around them, of course, more rain, you get more grass, you get more cows. Population growth is extremely high in these areas. The populations are, it's one of the area where the population growth is fastest around the world. So lots of human population going up as well. And they've got more cows and more of this, that, and the other. And they're also throwing fertilizer on the ground now. So everything is going up. And the result is an awful lot more rotting vegetation in the wetlands, and the wetlands getting wetter, and lots more cows, everything. And also lots more fires burning the crop wastes and goodness knows what. All these things are making methane. And more sewage from people, too.
Ewan, how do you know the growing levels of methane are not simply due to a change in atmospheric chemistry, which gives methane perhaps a longer lifetime or something that would bring higher levels without any increase on the ground?
Well, that's part of our big discussion we're having at the moment, and in particular this group in Harvard and Caltech who've been suggesting this, because along with climate change and all the various things we're throwing in the atmosphere, we run the risk of changing the cleaning power of the atmosphere. If you imagine water, H2O, well, HOH, if you knock off an H with reactions to do with light and oxygen, you'll get OH, and that's called the policeman of the atmosphere. The OH is what oxidizes all the bad species, all the pollutants. Plus, methane isn't strictly a pollutant. It's a natural greenhouse gas, but it oxidizes methane to carbon dioxide, which has far less warming impact per unit than methane does. So if you do something to change the OH, you're basically shooting the policeman. And that means that the methane will increase, the methane burden will increase. And it's possible that the OH in the atmosphere, particularly in certain areas where pollution from other gases is bad, that may have been declining. And therefore the methane would go up because there's less policemen to catch the bad guys.
As you know, there's almost a competition for other ideas for the sources of the new methane growth. What about the increasing super wildfires in recent years as the planet heats up?
Now, this is where the carbon isotopes come in. Yeah, wildfires could be happening. Actually, in the last few years, there's some evidence suggesting actually the amount of wildfires in the tropics is declining rather than increasing. But that varies quite a lot. Now, the methane that comes from fires tends to be relatively rich in carbon-13. And there's a discussion, a suggestion from John Worden in NASA JPL. He suggested that actually methane from natural gas leaks is increasing. But because the fires have been decreasing, it's sort of hiding the isotopic effect on the carbon-12-13 ratio. And so maybe fires have been decreasing, but emissions from gas leaks and so on have been increasing, and that could be part of the cause as well. Now, all of these things that are driving the methane budget, they're not exclusive. They could all be happening, and the question is working out the proportion. And for that, we use what are called inverse models. You take all the measurements you've got around the world, and then you take all the isotopes as well, and then you do a giant mathematical model, but you've got to add in the winds and the fact that the methane gets blown from A to B. And so it's pretty complicated computing. And you can try to figure out where the source areas are, what's putting what in. But it's a tough one.
You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. As always, I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Ewan Nisbet, Professor of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway in London. We're talking about a new surge of methane as dangerous warming gas into the atmosphere. Scientists tell us carbon dioxide tends to become evenly distributed in the global atmosphere. Is that true of methane? And if not, can localized methane drive localized warming?
Methane mixes across the planet in about a year. If you actually look at where methane is, there's sort of waterfall on the hemispheric boundary, which is the intertropical convergence. It's significantly higher in the northern hemisphere. The methane death zone is where OH is strongest, and that's in the moist air where the sun is very bright, and that's in the tropical belt where the sun's vertical in daytime. So methane blows southwards. There's southern hemisphere sources as well, but the overwhelming sources are in the northern hemisphere. CO2 mixes as well. In terms of local regions, yes, the methane mixes. The bigger impacts locally are, of course, air pollution. For example, China and India live under a very, very heavy haze, if you've ever been to Beijing in November. And increasingly now, heavily populated parts of Africa also, particularly in the dry season, very, very strong burning. So that's actually probably got a big impact on local temperatures. And then we've a huge amount of deforestation going on. Not entirely. Some areas are actually growing forest. And that changes local temperature as well. So all these factors are going on. So each local area has got its own particular factors happening to warm it, or if it's heavily under a burden of horrendous pollution, it might cool it, depending on what's happening locally.
You were very interested in methane coming out of the Arctic, and we do have a lot of warnings that perhaps clathrates, that the frozen methane under shallow seabeds might thaw and emit more methane. Should we take our eyes off the Arctic now that we know that the tropics are the source of the new increase?
No. If you're in a boxing match and somebody's hitting you upwards, you don't take your eyes off the other hand. No, I was actually the person who suggested that a long time ago in the 80s when I worked in Saskatoon. And we have found a while ago strong evidence, for example, off Spitsbergen of plumes of methane coming up in several hundred meters of water. Now, the nice thing is that methane is released into the water, or in the permafrost, it's coming up through the permafrost, but it gets picked up by methanotrophic bacteria. It's food for them. They take the methane and essentially convert it to CO2 and make a living out of that. So essentially, they're doing what you do when you burn gas. And between them and dissolution in the water, they're pretty efficient. So it gets up through 100 meters of water or so, but we get five flasks a week from Spitsbergen. These are air flasks, because we're watching for exactly that. And as far as we can tell, the Arctic is not releasing significant amounts of methane from hydrates at the moment. There may be burps from particular sources occasionally, but if you look in the Arctic in the summer, the methane comes from the Arctic wetlands. The isotopes are pretty clear on that. In the winter, the main sources seem to be the gas fields. Russia's, some of the world's biggest gas fields are in the Siberian Arctic. And you can measure, say, in Spitsbergen, and then track the air back to where it last touched ground, and that will be in over the gas fields. So we think at the moment the Arctic is not leading the world in methane growth. In 2007, there was a period where there was strong growth. That appeared probably to be in air that was blown from very warm boreal regions, northern Canada, northern Siberia, up into the high Arctic. So right now the Arctic is not at the top of our worry list, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't look at it. It's very important we look at it. Canada's got a very important station at ALERT, which is measuring the air. Norway measures in Spitsbergen, Americans in Barrow. And there's a station run with the Russians and the Finns at a place called Tixi. So there is a bit of watching in the Arctic. We get flasks from ALERT and from Spitsbergen, and we're watching it pretty carefully. But right now, the concern is actually in the tropics.
Well, I'm glad to hear there's eyes on up there. So let's say the current trend of biogenic emissions continues. Why do you say that could affect the Paris Climate Agreement?
We think it's probably biogenic, but it could also be all these other factors as well. Whatever it is, methane is going up fast. Now, essentially, the Paris Agreement allows you a certain amount of warming. The agreement was either 1.5 or 2 degrees, and that translates into so much emission. It's not very much of CO2 and CH4 before we hit our limit. How do you get there? One way of getting there is to, which was really thought of in the scenarios that led to the Paris Agreement, was that we can probably get methane under some degree of control, because a significant proportion of the methane comes from the natural gas and coal industries, and that's relatively easy to reduce. So if we do that, that gives us a little bit more time to basically change the world's economy and get CO2 emissions under control. However, if methane is rocketing up, that leaves you far less sort of carbon dioxide space if you're going to hit the Paris target. And it's going up so much that the sort of emission space that we've got before 2100 is getting quite significantly less than was thought of when everyone signed the Paris Agreement. So it threatens the Paris Agreement quite badly.
Well, obviously, we could cut emissions that are leaking out of our pipelines and fracking pads and all that sort of thing and change over to renewables. But is there anything we humans can do to reduce the new surge of methane coming from the tropics and the southern hemisphere?
Complex. The first thing to do is exactly what you said, cut the natural gas emissions and the coal emissions. And actually, the frackers, the recent work on the frackers, have been pretty good. Some of the early work by NOAA, by people like Anna Carrion and Gabby Petron, showed that the frackers were losing, say, 9% of their gas just to air. Nowadays, the more recent work has shown that they've cut those leaks very significantly, and in some fracking areas, the leaks have come down enormously, probably because that's profit. If you leak gas, that's profit. But there's still huge losses from the gas industry and from the coal industry. The good side is that our ability to detect where emissions are coming from is very much better than it used to be. For big leaks, you can put sensors on drones and so on. For small leaks, all you do is you drive around with an instrument, and you can locate the leak pretty well. Once you know where the leak is, stopping it is a no-brainer. That's also true of gas distribution leaks in urban areas. We drive around London and we pick up all the leaks. If only we can just persuade the industry to stop those leaks, it would take a huge amount out. Coal mines, another one. We really need to do something about it. Now, in the tropics, different problem. First of all, the cow part of it, which is pretty significant, there's discussion about how much of it, but it's quite a lot. The cow superpowers are countries like India, Ethiopia, Brazil, South Sudan, where a cow is a very major part of the culture. And trying to reduce that is quite complex. Trying to persuade Westerners to eat a bit less meat, that's okay. But you've got to be careful, because if you, for example, replace an organic cow on a pasture in Scotland with something intensively grown agriculture somewhere in the tropics, which you've now imported or some whatever, you're not necessarily winning on greenhouse terms. So it's a pretty complex argument. But we could certainly reduce the agricultural emissions and do a lot more to do that. It's not as easy as reducing the gas industry, but it helps. With the wetlands, not much, except try to be careful about letting fertilizers run into them, but I suspect that's not possible. What we could do, though, is reduce some of the biomass burning in the tropics, particularly as that's also a major cause of air pollution. And it exports agricultural soil nutrients to the air and eventually to the oceans. Africa's fires are feeding the fish in the Atlantic and actually feeding Amazonia eventually.
I did not know that. Another exciting new fact from science.
Burn your plant and it goes up in the air and all the nutrients go with it. Got to land somewhere. And in Africa in particular, they burn that crazy. I'm Zimbabwean, as you probably got from my accent. Sorry, Zimbabwean Canadian. It's a mess. So I grew up with these fires, and in Harare in July, August, you choke. Well, it depends on the year, but some years.
We're choking here now in July and August, but it's due to wildfires. We've had wildfire emergencies every year for the last 3 years.
I spent a lot of time as a geologist mapping in northern Canada, so I know those fires. Scary sometimes, too.
So this steep curve of atmospheric methane isn't happening in isolation from other steep curves for both carbon dioxide and global temperatures. In that scenario, is it possible we could experience a burst of extra heating in part due to a methane spike?
Well, I wouldn't call it a spike. We don't know where it's going. We know the upside. We don't know if there's a downside on it. a spike implies a downside. Yeah, it's pretty worrying. If it carries on growing at the current rate, we're in pretty serious trouble. Now, I shouldn't be entirely doom and gloom. We do have one very, very good story, which is the banning of the chlorofluorocarbons through the Montreal Protocol. And that primarily was done by Margaret Thatcher, who sat down and read the science and then persuaded George Bush the First that this was really, really important. But she was an excellent chemist, and so she read the scientific papers, I'm told. And the CFCs, apart from saving the ozone, and if they hadn't done that, by now the ozone problems worldwide would be very, very serious indeed, affecting an awful lot of life, including plant life and early crops. But as well as doing that, the CFCs are very powerful greenhouse gases. And one of the most effective actions we've ever taken on the greenhouse was to ban the CFCs. That was a huge and effective action. We can do the same sort of thing with methane, really trying to reduce gas leaks, coal mine emissions.
I remember, too, James Hansen and George Bush the Second came out with the methane control program, which included trying to harvest it from dumps and landfills, and they had a whole program to do that.
No, actually, to be fair, in Europe and North America, landfills now, we do a lot of work around landfills, are emitting far, far less than they used to. But what has surprised me is the extent recently of landfills in the tropics. When I was a child in Africa, all of our rubbish went in a hole in the ground, and we threw some ash on it, but basically it got oxidized. It didn't produce. It was just in the backyard, really. Nowadays, all over the tropics, there's some very big cities with very big open landfills, and very often these landfills are on fire as well, and they're an obvious thing to do something about. Simplest thing you need to do is just put some soil on it, and then the methanotrophic bacteria will have a habitat, and they'll eat the methane coming off. You know, that's very simple technology. Most landfills in Europe are very heavily piped and instrumented, and then you take off the methane and you make electricity with that at stage two. And that's quite doable with tropical landfills also, and we need to be doing that. So I would put landfills as pretty high on my list, tropical landfills, for mitigation efforts, because right now they're just heaps.
You and Nisbet, we're pretty close to our time here, but what are your next steps for your research here?
Pretty complicated. I'd like to do a lot more work on the isotopes in the tropics to figure out what the signatures of the emissions are. I also have a long-term pet project, which has spent years trying to get going, to put a decent observatory on Ascension Island in the central Atlantic. We have Mauna Loa, which is essential in the Pacific. But in the Atlantic, in the remote Atlantic, we have flasks from Ascension Island, but we don't actually have sort of continuous, steady measurement of lots and lots of gases. And it's an ideal site, and we really ought to try to do something there. But that's taken years, and it sort of staggers along.
From the UK, we've been speaking with Dr. Ewan Nisbet, Professor of Earth Sciences at the Royal Holloway, University of London. You can find links to his team's paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ewan, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been fun talking to you. Thanks a lot.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Thank you for listening this week. Don't forget to follow up with my show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Please support your local nonprofit radio station, Radio EcoShock, and pass the word on to your contacts on social media. It all helps. Thank you for caring about our world.
I started out working with our city on a local level with iMatter, and we helped our city get a grade on climate change. We gave them a report card on how they were doing at addressing climate change at a local level. And then we presented that to them along with a youth climate inheritance resolution that asked them to create a climate action plan, include youth in decision making that has to do with climate change and the environment, and start the creation of their climate action plan within 3 months or something. And so we did a lot of presentations around our community, me and my Nordic Nature group, and we got signatures and had a bunch of people show up, and our resolution passed to a standing ovation.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
In the UK, what wound up happening was the Integrity Initiative's Twitter account was promoting all of these attacks on Jeremy Corbyn. And then when it emerges that this Twitter account and this organization is actually funded by the Tory government, you start to understand that this is kind of a coup, a very British coup against Jeremy Corbyn. I think the most principled progressive leader in the West who has a hope of taking leadership of a major Western country.
There's also a tie with, you know, Trump administration officials with the Integrity Initiative. You mentioned in your article on the Gray Zone project that you wrote with Mark Ames, you talked about Sebastian Gorka and his wife and yeah. their ties to the Integrity Initiative. Can you talk a little bit about that and what impact that connection has had or did have?
Well, you know, the Integrity Initiative's director, who's a British army colonel and reservist who is a military intelligence specialist, Chris Donnelly, has a long-standing relationship with Sebastian Gorka. He actually approved Sebastian Gorka's thesis at a diploma mill in Hungary called Corvinus University. It was as a literal diploma mill, and it was wow. like a fake thesis. One of the other figures who approved the thesis was on the panel of three, I think, was a right-wing Hungarian legislator who had proposed putting pigs' heads on stakes on Hungary's borders to prevent Syrian refugees from entering the country.
Oh, my God.
Really? So this is a really
I mean, that's such a boneheaded Islamophobic thing, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it's no, there's pigs' heads. We'll just go back and die. You know, we can't, walk around the pigs' heads. Like, what are you going to do, make a wall of pigs' heads? yeah, it was the stupidest. Well, these are not, you know, the brightest people, but Sebastian Gorka, he's definitely clever.
It speaks to that's interesting because it speaks to the extremism of the Integrity Initiative to be associated with Sebastian Gorka in right. such a close way.
Yeah, I mean, these are not sober-minded people, although they have managed to really inculcate themselves in places that we consider to be, you know, the left of center, moderate realms of opinion making, you know, the Guardian, for example, the Times of London.
And so from that perspective, it's really interesting that the main defenders of this seems to have been, liberal Guardianista types, really.
Yeah.
I listened a few weeks ago. I listened to the Novara Media podcast, this left wing organization in the UK, who do a lot of good stuff. And they had Paul Mason on. Now, Paul Mason has been a Corbyn supporter, but I mean, I have to say, he's absolutely terrible on foreign questions.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to this guy, but I guess I never understood why he was this leftist hero in the first place.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, I think when I was on your podcast, you kind of almost tried to warn me about him. And he was talking, and you know, you were right, really. I mean, he was talking about the Integrity Initiative, and his attitude was very much to play it down. So, what is your response to people who sort of say, and this was Paul Mason's attitude really, was, it's just a few tweets and, you know, so what? And they're allowed to tweet and, you know, so what? What, you know, how it's not significant, you know. What do you say to that?
Yeah, there's been more coverage of the Integrity Initiative in places like The Guardian or Huffington Post UK to say nothing to see here than there has been about the actual content of the documents. And so that's why I devoted, you know, so much time and resources to it at the Gray Zone, at my website, the Gray Zone Project, just because in the US there's been absolutely zero coverage of it. And I think that if you look at the Integrity Initiative, and this will go back to Nora's question, in isolation, then yeah, it just seems like some kind of, you know, old crank guy, military veterans in an office trying to, you know, spin the public. But, you know, if you look at how much resources were put behind it by the British government, and if we actually knew the extent to which they were able to influence mainstream media and how much these reporters who are saying nothing to say here actually were invested in this initiative, I think we'd be shocked. But beyond that, I mean, if you look at what they're trying to do in the U.S. and how they talk about the Gorkhas, Catherine Gorkha is Sebastian Gorkha's wife. She's in the Department of Homeland Security. She's a deeply Islamophobic figure. Gorkha himself is not in the Trump administration anymore. He was kind of Trump's pit bull in the media. Now he has a deal with Sinclair Media, which controls, you know, in the red states and middle America. I mean, you can't avoid Sinclair Media. They control local news. They control the radio. They
give scripts to all their news anchors across the country to read the exact same, you know, line propagandizing for the Trump administration.
Yeah, there's that famous video that showed all of Sinclair's anchors, but, you know, you could actually do that with, you know.
Yeah, it's not very far off from what anchors do in the networks anyway. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But Sebastian Gorkha has a deal with Sinclair where his commentary every day has to appear on every Sinclair radio station. So he's basically, you know, it's like Gorkha being, you know, injected Clockwork Orange style through the eyeballs of American heartland residents straight into their cerebral cortex until they start thinking like and acting like Sebastian Gorkha. And it's really scary. So
I feel I should add at this point, like for listeners who don't know, Sebastian Gorkha, the former Trump advisor, right? He was a top advisor in the White House. This guy is a full on fascist. Like according to the Forward's reporting, has done some good reporting on this. He is a sworn member of the Vitezi Rend, I think that's how you say it.
Yeah.
A Hungarian fascist organization, which collaborated with Hitler during the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And, you know, he tries to sort of say, oh, you know, well, it's just a medal.
That was then, this is now, yeah.
Yeah, like, oh, we were critical of the Nazis, you know. But, yeah, I mean, these are the facts. I mean, this is a really hard right extremist. And I didn't know, actually, about that media deal that he has right now.
The Vitezi Rend are sort of admirers of Miklos Horthy, who was the monarchist-style leader imposed on the Hungarian population during the Nazi German occupation of Hungary. And the line among the Horthy men, the people who, you know, think like Sebastian Gorkha does, is that, you know, they needed to make this compromise because they were holding off Stalin's Soviet Union as well, and that's who would have taken over and who did take over. If they hadn't backed Horthy, then they claim that Horthy limited the damage to the local Jewish population, but while it's true that the worst pogroms were towards the end of World War II, there were mass deportations of Jews under his watch. And, you know, I have good fascist dar. On election night, Sebastian Gorkha just decided to go in front of the cameras wearing a Vitezi Rend uniform, which is an all-black collarless uniform with medals on it. And it just looks like he's coming out of a Mel Brooks play. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And then he wants us to not talk about the Vitezi Rend, even though he's wearing its uniform on election night. And of course, what was his defense? It's the defense of like Steve King, the white nationalist legislator from Iowa, and everyone once they get caught out there being fascistic. I support Israel. I love Israel.
Yes. Yes.
I can't hate the Jews because I love Israel. They all love Israel because the Jews are over there and they're not here. So
yeah, exactly.
You don't have.
I mean, this is interesting to me. This is the really interesting aspect of the whole integrity initiative thing to me, because it really speaks to the extremism of it. Like, so and in that respect, it reminds me of another project, a disinformation project of the British state from the 70s and 80s in Northern Ireland, where it called. Do you know, Max, about Operation Clockwork Orange and Colin Wallace?
This is going to be new to me.
There's a great book that I can recommend everyone read about it from the 80s by a really good British journalist, the late great Paul Foote. And it's called Who Framed Colin Wallace? And Colin Wallace essentially was a whistleblower who was working for British military intelligence in Northern Ireland, in the north of Ireland. His job was to put out disinformation. It was actively faked information. So it spanned the spectrum between just stuff that was true, but it was there, you know, the British narrative against the IRA and, you know, other people who were considered to be enemies of the state, up until like purely faked information, like fake documents to try and discredit the IRA, to discredit the broader Republican movement, and all this kind of stuff. But what happened was, because the people in the British intelligence services behind all this was so extreme right, that it started to expand. Their mission started to expand, and it was in this Cold War atmosphere whereby anyone who sort of disagreed with what would nowadays be called the Anglo-Saxon worldview.
Yeah.
was considered to be, you know, an enemy. So what happened was they started to put a disinformation campaign against the Labour government on the mainland, and their disinformation was a large part of the reason that the Harold Wilson government was kind of overthrown, really, in almost a soft coup. And you know, Harold Wilson was nowhere near as left wing as Jeremy Corbyn. Again, it's kind of a complicated story, but I mean, that's the broad outlines of it. But what really reminds me of it, the Integrity Initiative reminds me of Operation Clockwork Orange. There's parallels there. You know, they were both targeting the Labour Party. It's not a Labour government yet here nowadays, and they were both sort of hard right. The forces behind it were hard right extremists, really. I mean, that was what wasn't clear to me at first in the case of the Integrity Initiative. But I mean, reading your article about it and the mention of Gorka especially, it really strikes me. And one of the documents you linked to about the interview with the British army officer saying that the military should be free of democratic oversight. Right?
Yes, yes. I mean, the extremism is really clear. It's a military push. It's an attempt to kind of to impose military control over all aspects of society. I talked about the speech that was made by a staffer of Chris Donnelly in Seattle at the opening event of the Integrity Initiative in the U.S., which was kind of covert. It was held under the auspices of a data firm. And, you know, I've managed to turn up the video of it, which they've since deleted.
Yeah, I noticed a whole load of the links in your article, the pages have been deleted or scrubbed or changed in
as well as
ways.
Their entire Twitter account, right? Just in the last week or so.
Yeah, the Integrity Initiative's Twitter account is now locked, and they've deleted the Institute for Statecraft's website, which is the think tank that's the parent organization of it. But you know,
so I hope you have good backups. But I mean, it's a good sign of how they're kind of scared of your reporting, really.
Well, I'm not the only one doing it, and you know, there's a reporter who's been doing an incredible job named Kit Clarenberg, who happens to be at Sputnik, which is the Russian-backed outlet. But you know, Kit is just a pure reporter, and he recognizes the importance of it, and he's driven them crazy. And they've tried to write it off and say, "Well, Russia's behind this, yada yada," but it's all true. So
yeah.
It's like they say, there's conspiracy theories and there's conspiracy facts, and this falls into the latter category. But yeah, at the Seattle event, this young staffer is reading a letter by Chris Donnelly, the head of the Integrity Initiative, and you look at the content of it, and it's frightening. He's saying business executives, opinion makers, people who work in you know, the intelligence field, but also who are in civil society, all need to understand that we are at war with Russia, and we need to abandon the peacetime mentality and start adopting a wartime mentality that produces innovation and risk-taking. And, you know, using this euphemistic language, which could be interpreted to lead to some really disturbing consequences. And that is what, you know, is being said in the offices of places like the Atlantic Council as well, which is listed as a partner organization of the Integrity Initiative, which shares staff. I mean, there's a huge overlap between the Integrity Initiative and the Atlantic Council. And that's where I wanted to pick up on Nora's question and on your question about Paul Mason downplaying this initiative. The Integrity Initiative is just one aspect of a vast information warfare network that, you know, at least focuses most explicitly on Russia, but leads towards a new Cold War with China, as well as, you know, the recolonization of Latin America, and of course, permanent U.S. occupation of countries, or at least a permanent U.S. presence in countries in the Middle East. That's the agenda. Yeah. The Atlantic Council is extremely influential in Washington. I mean, their office is right there on K Street. They're funded by NATO. They're funded by the Gulf states. They're funded by the arms industry. And, you know, a who's who of, you know, experts, self-styled experts, is going to be there every day. Last Monday, they were celebrating Bolsonaro at a panel discussion. And they're talking not just about Europe, but about the whole world. And they're partnered with other think tanks, like the Center for European Policy Analysis, which has many of the same kind of arms industry and NATO-related funders. And they're running basically an information warfare campaign that's targeting the minds of the Western public through their cutouts and friends and fronts in the media. And so right now, the agenda has focused on exploiting the panic of Democrats and liberals and people who had typically been sort of suspicious of international conflict and war, their panic around Trump to open up opportunities to get on this war footing with Russia, because the Clinton campaign was so eager to blame Russia and Russian bots and Russian hackers for Donald Trump's victory. And they've successfully done that. They've triumphed. They've gotten Rachel Maddow to carry their narrative to like 60 and 70 something semi-retired liberals who don't really know jack shit about the outside world and were happy to accept this. And those are the people that were solidly against George W. Bush's war in Iraq. And now Rachel Maddow is one of the top rated shows in the country. So they've pulled off this kind of cultural coup and brought us close to a new Cold War. What happens next is anybody's guess, but the Integrity Initiative is very clear that there's nothing more we can do in Washington. Like, we've won there. Our partner organizations have just basically taken over. And you had yesterday an insane vote on a resolution in the House Donald Trump cannot take the U.S. out of NATO. Donald Trump has no plans to take the U.S. out of NATO. It was this whole thing was based on like a leak from John Bolton to embarrass Trump, and basically every single member of the House, except for a few Republicans, voted for this symbolic resolution. Every Democrat voted for it. And that really shows what the atmosphere in Washington is like. There's no debate about NATO anymore. I think we should be debating whether, you know, the U.S. should be, whether NATO should exist, at least on the left. But that debate is over. So what the Integrity Initiative said it has to do is start to like span out across the country into the heartland and foment Russophobia and a new Cold War fever among, you know, the people in Cedar Rapids. And that's what the Seattle event was about. That's what Sebastian Gorka being at Sinclair is kind of about. They're looking to work with people on both sides of the aisle. There is this extremism, as you said, but it doesn't mean that they only want to work with right wingers. I think ideally,
of course not.
I think the ideal situation is what, you know, for these information warriors is to enjoy the kind of allies that they've had on Syria, where you have these self-styled lefties like Paul Mason, who are ramping up the are projecting the narrative of military intervention. And, you know, there was an influence operation very similar to the Integrity Initiative on a smaller scale, funded by a Syrian British billionaire named Ayman Asfari, as well as some other Gulf elements, called the Syria Campaign. And they employed staffers from Avaz, which is the global clicktivist organization, which is influential in drumming up support in the West, especially on the left side of the spectrum, for intervening in Libya. They drew from those staffers to create a public relations arm that went hand in glove with the creation of the White Helmets organization. And then they, you know, ginned up this humanitarian interventionist narrative about saving the children in Syria through a no-fly zone. And the people who formed the echo chamber around the Syria campaign were people that are more identified with the left. So, you know, you faint left and move right. That's much more effective and much, I mean, the more insidious you can get, the more effective you can be, because what you want to do is isolate your opposition by winning over a portion of it, fragmenting it, causing it to fight among itself. That was very successful on the issue of Syria. On the issue of Russia, there really isn't a debate in the U.S. There is in the U.K., but in the U.S., everyone's afraid of being called like a Russian asset. So there isn't even a debate here on that. That's frightening. And, you know, of course, there isn't any discussion about invading Russia or, I mean, this is the genius of these, of the kind of military mindset that shapes policy now, is that it focuses more on kind of soft coups, and color revolutions, and information warfare than direct conventional warfare. And so there's going to naturally be less public opposition because it's less in the public eye.
I think this is like exactly the point about the Integrity Initiative. Like, the point is not that they made a few tweets. The tweets are just indicative of their agenda.
Right.
And what else? The point is, what else are they doing that we don't know about? And, you know, hopefully more can be revealed about that. I mean, and this is why I mentioned it in my, you know, in my article, I mentioned it in passing in my article about the Troll network, which is spewing anti-Semitism and framing Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, which we discussed in the previous podcast. But I think, as you say, like, millions of pounds are going into the Integrity Initiative, have been going into the Integrity Initiative. You know, that money and what it buys is not going, you know, it's not going nowhere. You know, they're not flushing it down the toilet. You know, okay, maybe they're making boastful claims about what they can do. Okay, well, they're still doing something. So what are they doing? You know, and it's kind of, it's foolish to me for the people on the left to say, it's just a few tweets, because that's really, that's akin to
like putting your fingers in your ears and sort of saying, oh, well, you know, advertising doesn't affect me, basically.
when they lock their Twitter account, it's like, oh, it's okay now. It's all over. We don't even have to worry about them anymore. They're gone.
Right. Well,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to understand how they're being, what they're thinking right now, but clearly they're in a state of kind of damage control, crisis management. These are people who think that they're the masters of crisis management, but you should really imagine how they would perform in an actual war based on their performance, where they just have a few reporters. They have some guy from Sputnik showing up at their door and like me writing stuff on the Gray Zone project and like, you know, a bunch of academics in the UK who are tweeting things about them. And then they just have to completely close up shop and like go hide in a bunker. It's like, someone should do, you know, a remix of, the Hitler movie Downfall, where they're in the bunker, but they're doing the voices of the Integrity Initiative. I mean, these guys are definitely like some serious military bunglers who, really show where the UK is at right now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tim Shorrock, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who assesses the failure of the recent Trump-Kim summit meeting in Vietnam and prospects for future negotiations with the goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Elizabeth Yompierre, co-founder of UpRose, the oldest Latino community organization in New York City, who urges individuals doing climate organizing to respect the work already being done in frontline communities. And Timothy Carr of the media democracy group Free Press, who outlines a new proposal that would impose a tax on targeted social media advertisements in order to revitalize endangered local journalism. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The release of a captured Indian fighter pilot diffused the latest military confrontation between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. The pilot was shot down during the first aerial dogfight over the disputed territory since 1971. The latest round of fighting between the nuclear-armed South Asian neighbours was prompted by a suicide attack on a convoy of India's soldiers by the Islamist group Jaish-e-Mohammed, based in Pakistan. After the suicide attack, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is running for re-election, promised a jaw-dropping response to the terror attack in Kashmir, a flashpoint for conflict since the 1940s. India attacked what they claimed were terrorist camps on Pakistan's side of the so-called line of control in Kashmir. Pakistan responded by bombing targets in Indian territory. Each side says it has shot down the other nation's planes. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan said that the Indian pilot's release was a peace gesture, a move that was enthusiastically welcomed by India's people in a large welcome home rally. Global powers, including Russia, China, Britain, and the United States, have urged nuclear-armed Pakistan and India to defuse the crisis. In 2018, over 500 people were killed in violence in Kashmir, the most in a decade. A month before a snap election, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces an indictment on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The charges relate to a wide-ranging investigation of corruption by Netanyahu over his links to a high-powered Hollywood producer, U.S. billionaire Sheldon Adelson, and Israel's largest telecom giant, Bezeq. Netanyahu returned from a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin to blast the charges as a witch hunt by Israel's Attorney General, Avichai Mandelblit. In the election, Netanyahu faces off against political newcomer Benny Gantz, former head of the Israeli Armed Forces and candidate of the centrist Blue and White Party Alliance. With the pending indictment, Gantz called on Netanyahu to resign. A decade ago, former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was forced out of office and later served a year and a half in jail for taking bribes. Netanyahu is accused of accepting $280,000 worth of gifts in exchange for political favours that include his support for the Milchan Law that cut taxes for Israelis returning to their homeland after living abroad, and a quid pro quo arrangement with a major Israeli newspaper that agreed to tone down its critical coverage of the Israeli Prime Minister in return for pressure to limit the circulation of a competing free newspaper owned by American billionaire Sheldon Adelson. Time is running out on 1.4 million Puerto Ricans who have relied on emergency food assistance since Hurricane Maria devastated the island in 2017. Without new appropriations from Congress, over 100,000 people will lose all food aid and tens of thousands will see their assistance cut. Before Hurricane Maria, 45% of Puerto Ricans were living in poverty, three times the poverty rate in the U.S. The American Prospect reports that efforts by Democrats to continue the food aid were blocked by the Trump administration during budget talks to end the federal government shutdown tied to President Trump's demand for funding for his border wall. In the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, Congress boosted funding for food stamps by $1.27 billion, but Puerto Rican officials warned that the amount was insufficient and requested $600 million additional dollars to continue the program through September of this year. According to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, without new funding, the maximum food aid benefit for a family of four would be reduced from $649 a month to $410. The Trump administration opposed any additional food aid to Puerto Rico, saying it is excessive and unnecessary. In the end, the spending bill passed by Congress and the White House didn't include any funds for disaster assistance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The second summit meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Hanoi, Vietnam, ended without the hoped-for signing of an agreement that would have North Korea begin the process of ending its nuclear weapons program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions. Trump blamed Kim for the failure to reach an agreement on his demand for complete sanctions relief in exchange for dismantling the North's main nuclear complex at Yongbyon. But North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho disputed Trump's explanation, saying that Pyongyang had only demanded partial sanctions relief in return for the closing of Yongbyon. He asserted that the U.S. had wasted an opportunity that may not come again. But according to a South Korean official, the unexpected participation in the talks by Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton, well known for his pro-war hawkish views and disdain for diplomacy, derailed the negotiations when he demanded the North turn over a full accounting of all of its chemical and biological weapons. Your reporter spoke with Tim Shorrock, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who spent part of his youth living in South Korea. Here he assesses the outcome of the Trump-Kim summit meeting and prospects for future negotiations with the goal of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula.
The talk was before this meeting began, it looked like they were, talking about North Korea offering to shut down Yongbyon facility, which is their largest nuclear, it produces plutonium for their bombs. It also is a uranium enrichment plant. It's a huge complex. They were talking about, shutting that down, and in return getting, you know, sort of a partial lifting of sanctions from the U.S., the sanctions that have been imposed on the North. And also there was talk of both sides opening liaison offices in each other's capital and making a declaration that they support the end of the Korean War. But there got to be a lot of pushback inside the administration from the forces that are, you know, led by John Bolton, and Trump's national security advisor, who's never been a friend of negotiating with North Korea. And, you know, there was leaks in the press about how certain officials thought, you know, Trump was going to give away the store, and they didn't think that policy was on track and so on. And so, you know, it was very clear that there was some dissension within the administration. Kind of at the last minute, Bolton threw on the table a demand that North Korea also shut down all its, you know, its chemical and biological weapon systems. And this was not even part of the denuclearization talks. And so, you know, he added this, you know, at the Hanoi meeting. And that also, you know, chilled the atmosphere for dialogue. I mean, you know, you're here, you have this negotiation supposed to be about nuclear weapons, suddenly you throw in, like, you know, everything else. And that was, you know, in my opinion, that was sort of designed to make the talks fail.
Tim, I wanted to ask you, I guess this is certainly an overarching question. When a lot of American commentators are asked about these talks and the prospects for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, there's a lot of folks, moderate commentators, folks from right wing and moderate think tanks and so on, who say Kim will never give up nuclear weapons because it's the only insurance policy he has to keep his family dynasty in power. There are certainly people who will point out that Libya is a cautionary tale, where the United States worked to denuclearize Libya's in-progress nuclear program. And then, you know, some years later, as we all know, Gaddafi was overthrown and killed. It is a cautionary tale for many nations around the world that if you have the nukes, the United States will not be overthrowing your government anytime soon. What do you make of the analysis that Kim will never give up the nukes because it's the only insurance policy he has?
You know, I don't agree. I think it's very possible he would. But like I said, I think there has to be a situation where he feels his country is secure, you know, without them. And actually, you know, no chance of a U.S., you know, regime change operation or invasion or attack. And so, you know, that you know, like the first two steps of the agreement that they made in Singapore was, one, to establish new North Korea-U.S. relations, and two, you know, work toward a, you know, peace system between North and South Korea. And so, like, to them, like, you know, it's never had one really before. Creating a new relationship with the U.S. where they're no longer enemies is their priority. And that's why they have the weapons. And if they feel like that, if they can have a relationship and, you know, develop economic ties, cultural ties, then that's when, you know, denuclearization would be at the last stage of that. And that's sort of how the South Koreans see it, too. Not denuclearization as an end in and of itself, but as the end of a process in which the U.S. and South Korea stop being enemy states and be at least, you know, on a normal relationship like you have with other countries. Not necessarily friends or allies, but, you know, no longer enemies. I disagree with people who say that. And there's also a lot of propaganda here among the think tanks and these sort of, you know, huge new generation of, you know, North Korea so-called experts, you know, who say North Korea's real aim is to drive U.S. forces out of South Korea and unify the country under their own system, which is, you know, I think that's bunk.
That was Tim Sharrock, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist and author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing.
Find links to Shorrock's recent articles on the Korean summit and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 9th Annual Conference on New Directions in Environmental Law took place at Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies on March 2nd. Organizers of the gathering maintained that climate change is the greatest threat to social justice, human rights, and progress around the world. Conference participants explored existing challenges and legal and policy solutions to the crisis, placing climate justice at the center of the discussion. Those speaking at the conference addressed topics including the impact of the climate crisis on immigration, incarcerated individuals, low-income communities, and communities of color. Also explored were responses to climate change that will generate justice and equity. One of the conference keynote speakers was Elizabeth Yompierre, co-founder of UPROSE, the oldest Latino community organization in New York City, who also serves as co-chair of the National Climate Justice Alliance. Yompierre, who's of African and indigenous descent, focused her remarks on the need for those doing climate organizing to respect the work already being done in frontline communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the conference and brings us this excerpt of her talk.
When I was sitting listening to the compañera speak, I was reminded that the climate justice movement is led by women. We are a leaderful, intergenerational, grassroots movement, and the leaders throughout the country and in our communities are mostly women of color. I also was really heartened to see the word justice, because there are a lot of folks who think they understand what justice is, and are not. They are climate missionaries. They are climate colonizers. They are people who believe in climate change but don't know how to support the grassroots and really come in with the solutions and helicopter in to tell us what's in our best interest. So I guess my question for folks who say that they really care about climate change is, why are these organizations that are new and are developing right now, if they care about climate change, not mapping this country and assessing where the gaps are, where there's a need to build climate consciousness, where there's a need to basically get folks that are on the margins or even in the red states to start understanding the connection between climate change and their survivability? Instead, what all of these organizations are doing, and I'm not going to put them on blast and name them, is looking at places where there is already frontline leadership. Already frontline leadership, whether it's in Seattle, whether it's in the Gulf South, whether it's in Kentucky, whether it's in Brooklyn or the Bronx, whether it's in Detroit. All of them are meeting and making a beeline for our communities, getting a lot of resources to descend into our communities, supplant local leadership, duplicate work, create redundancy and a waste of resources, and colonize our communities by telling us that people of privilege seem to care more about climate change than we do, know more about climate change than we do, and really making it impossible for the front line to speak for itself. It is going to make us fail. We will lose if people continue to descend on the same communities, because descending on our communities and places that are already doing the work is lazy, it's easy, it's so much harder to roll up your sleeve and go into places where there is no climate consciousness. And so I'm saying that to you because just this week, a meeting being had in D.C. to talk about how to get people of color and low-income people to have a platform on the Green New Deal. Well, we have a platform on the Green New Deal. We responded to the Green New Deal. How many of you are supporters of the Green New Deal? All right, so when we looked at the Green New Deal, we had questions. We wanted to know why there was language in there about cap and trade. We wanted to know why there was language in there about sequestration and carbon capture and why it wasn't centered on frontline communities and why it wasn't building on the work on just transitions which our communities are doing. And a just transition is really an economic frame that moves us away from fossil fuel extraction to a regenerative economy, the kind of work that you see happening in our communities all over the country. And so we had a critique. And people responded to us in a negative way because we were critiquing the Green New Deal. Well, Alexandria comes from the Bronx, you know, and we felt like we had a right to say, activists don't sign a blank check. We want to make sure that frontline communities are centered, that we are creating holistic responses, that the resources are being invested locally in communities, that communities are not being displaced as a result of environmental amenities as they have when we want environmental successes. I know that in my community, when we doubled the amount of open space, stopped the siting of a power plant, had an aggressive urban forestry campaign, that developers started using our successes as a way of displacing us. So that can't happen, because when you basically supplant and push people out, you destroy social cohesion. And so it is really important for us to start really committing to building just relationships, engaging in self-transformation, and working with each other in a way that we have never worked with each other before. It means checking privilege. It means really challenging the way that you come to the work, because the truth is that we will not survive unless we deal with questions of race and the fact that really this is about the intersection of racial injustice and climate change, right? And so that is the harder thing to do. It is much easier to talk about bioswales and installing green roofs and thinking about infrastructure and how do we make sure that we have permeable surfaces. That is so much easier to talk about than to talk about issues of race. And we can't talk about climate change without talking about race. And we can't build relationships unless people are introspective and understand how they come to this work and how they use or abuse their privilege in this.
That was Elizabeth Yompierre of UPROSE and the Climate Justice Alliance. Find more discussion on the issues of climate change organizing by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the last decade and a half, the U.S. media landscape has changed dramatically, with, according to a 2018 study, 20% of the nation's newspapers have closed down since 2004, leaving 900 communities without local news resources. Another recent survey, conducted by the Pew Research Center, found that between 2003 and 2014, the number of full-time newspaper reporters covering state houses in the U.S. fell by 35%. These disturbing numbers, cited in a recent proposal from the media democracy group Free Press, provides the rationale for a new initiative to address the decline in U.S. journalism. In a paper co-written by Free Press staffers Timothy Carr and Craig Aaron titled Beyond Fixing Facebook, the group proposes the imposition of a new tax on targeted ads to fund civic-minded journalism. Your reporter spoke with Tim Carr, Free Press Senior Director of Strategy and Communications, who describes the decline in U.S. journalism, its impact on a functioning democracy, and how the proposed tax on major social media companies' targeted ads could strengthen locally owned, independent media outlets.
News organizations have been bleeding reporters for the last couple of decades, and a lot of the initial decline was really due to their own mismanagement and this trend that we've seen over the years towards media consolidation, where you have one company owning several television stations like Sinclair, or you have one company owning several newspapers like Tribune Media at one point. And what happens when this industry consolidates in this way? They like to use these terms of like synergies and things like that that would result from these mergers. But what synergies really means in the real world has been journalism layoffs. But in the last 10 years, we've seen also this transformation of the media economy. Commercial journalism was powered by advertising, whether it be print advertising or radio and television advertising. That was the money that supported reporters and kept many of them on the beat for quite some time. And in the last 10 years, that whole model has changed to online advertising. Online advertising is really controlled these days by just two companies. Facebook and Google control 70% of online advertising in the United States. But these two companies are not news organizations. They don't support journalists. They don't hire, they don't have newsrooms. They don't hire journalists. They don't have news producers. So you've seen this siphoning of money away from a media and economy that used to support journalism towards one where journalism is not, that has been factored out. And to add to that problem, we've also seen, and we've learned a lot in the last year, social networks like Facebook and Twitter and even Google expedite the spread of misinformation. We learned about Cambridge Analytica last year, which is a data firm that used Facebook data to misinform voters about the U.S. election, about the Brexit elections in the U.K. So not only are we losing journalists, we're also seeing the increased speed of the spread of information around the world. So it's become this sort of perfect storm, and that's why we have put forth this paper that I hope to talk about a little more.
Tim, lay out for our audience the proposal to impose a tax on targeted advertisements to fund what you term a civic-minded journalism.
Well, because there is this great imbalance in the media economy these days, and because we've seen the spread of misinformation do harmful things in democratic society, it's also fomented hatred and violence in other parts of the world. We have proposed a tax on the economy behind online platforms that really drives a lot of the Silicon Valley companies, and a tax of, for example, 2% in the United States would generate nearly $2 billion. And we've proposed creating what's called a public interest media endowment, where that money would go, and it would be similar in some ways to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, in that it's a quasi-governmental organization that then distributes that money to the sort of local, investigative, civic-minded journalism that we hope to see more of, a lot of the local journalism that we've lost over the last two decades.
Now, explain to our audience a bit about the public interest media endowment that you envision and how that entity would allocate funds.
Well, I mean, we've been thinking about this for a number of years now, and we've actually had some success on a very local level. Over the last couple years, we've been working in the state of New Jersey to create what's called the Civic Information Consortium. And as a result of money that New Jersey made from the sell-off of public media television station licenses, we've created this fund for the state of New Jersey, and it starts with just $5 million. We're hoping to raise more money for it from the state coffers that goes towards supporting local journalism. And as we've worked on that, we thought, well, we could scale this to a national model. A carbon tax is used by many countries to tax energy companies that are emitting dangerous emissions into the air. And that money is then used to clean up the mess they've made. Well, this is like a carbon tax in that we're taxing these social media companies to help clean up the mess they've made. And the best way to do that is to fund the antidote. The antidote to misinformation is good local journalism, good investigative journalism, civic engagement projects. So that's basically how we created this structure.
That was Tim Carr, Free Press Senior Director of Strategy and Communications, and co-author, along with Craig Aaron, of the group's new report titled Beyond Fixing Facebook. Find a link to the report and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests,
please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on REC FM in Riverton, Maryland, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Cops and Klansmen, colleagues. Cops survey a scene of conflict, a struggle between fascists and anti-fascists. Blood is on the ground, and webcam recordings show images of members of the Ku Klux Klan and related groups, not only armed with knives, but actually showing some men stabbing downward at writhing bodies on the ground. One side has knives. One side has signs. Guess which side received charges of violating the law? Guess which side had been surveyed by priests? 2-1, Mark. Guess which side had been surveilled by state and federal agents long before the events of the day? I'll give you a hint. It wasn't the Ku Klux Klan. According to reports published in The Guardian of London, police accounts concentrated on two major groups, anti-fascists and members of Black Lives Matter. In June 2016, anti-fascists assembled at a neo-Nazi rally in Sacramento, California. As expected, this rally was a site of high emotions. Violence erupted between the two sides, with at least 8 anti-fascists either stabbed, beaten, or both. How did it happen that none of the neo-Nazis were charged with anything, while anti-fascists were charged with everything? The answer is Donovan Ayers, a California highway patrolman, who was ordered to investigate the melee. He wrote hundreds of pages of notes advocating charges against the anti-fascists. As for the neo-Nazis, nothing. They have every right to protest, but what of those who oppose them? They, it seems, are simply troublemakers. Ayers did extensive online research on the anti-fascists, including email, Facebook, and even metadata. His research included Native American and Chicano groups who were anti-fascists. At the end of a hearing where Ayers testified, the DA was thanked by one courtroom observer for protecting white supremacists. One wonders, how does such a thing as this happen? And history provides a telling answer. For police and fascists have ever been brothers beneath their uniforms. During the 1930s, when the economy was in free fall, groups like the Industrial Workers of the World, known as the IWW or Wobblies, tried to organize agricultural workers, especially in California's fertile Central Valley, to protect the profits of the landowners. Police and Klansmen joined hands to attack Wobblies by beating, shooting, and arresting them as Klansmen attacked and assaulted their children. During this same period, as communists tried to organize black agricultural workers in Alabama, cops and Klansmen joined hands to repress and terrorize them, again, on behalf of wealthy landowners. One need only read No One is Illegal by Justin Akers Chacon and Mike Davis, or Robin D.G. Kelly's multi-award-winning book of history known as Hammer and Hoe. Today, once again, fascists have friends among American police in California, in Oregon, and beyond. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Why did elements of the U.S. national security state defy Kennedy's Vietnam withdrawal plans and immediately escalate the war after his assassination? What drove civil rights and black radical groups to oppose the Vietnam War before anyone else in America? What were the notable failures in journalistic coverage of the Gulf of Tonkin incident and the overall Vietnam War? How did the victors of the Vietnam War come to be a conquered country? On this week's Global Research NewsHour radio program, on the date marking the anniversary of the start of America's ground war in Vietnam, we review some of the underexplored aspects of the war. We hear from Professor Peter Dale Scott about the role of the deep state. We'll hear from Abiyomi Azikiwe about the role of black liberation movements in fostering opposition to the war. Barry Zwicker offers some thoughts about media coverage from the Gulf of Tonkin to the U.S. withdrawal. And we'll hear from Professor Michelle Chosadovsky about the decline of Vietnamese sovereignty in the wake of its victory over the U.S. 4 decades ago. On this week's program, Vietnam Anniversary, a legacy of resistance, deception, and human tragedy. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 8th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Late on March 3rd, battle tanks of the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, shelled positions of the Syrian Arab Army, or SAA, near Kars Nafal and Jubata al-Kashab in the province of Quneitra. Local sources said that the Israeli attack did not inflict casualties and revealed that these SAA positions remain empty most of the time. Following the attack, multiple Israeli warplanes, helicopters, and unmanned aerial vehicles were spotted flying over the Israeli-occupied part of the Golan Heights. A previous IDF strike in this area took place on February 11th. Then the attack targeted a Quneitra city hospital and an SAA position near Jubata al-Kashab, causing no casualties. That comes from a report under the headline Video Israel Delivers More Strikes on Syria by South Front, posted March 6th. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence's call on all Lima Group members to freeze the assets of Venezuela's oil company PDVSA and restrict visas for Venezuelan officials did not happen. Washington, on the other hand, has issued sanctions on the governors of four Venezuelan states. Ramon Carrizales, the governor of the Venezuelan state of Apure, who had previously served as vice president of Venezuela. Jorge Garcia Camero, the governor of the state of Vargas, who previously served as the head of the Venezuelan army and minister of defense. Rafael Lacava, governor of the state of Carabobo. And Omar Prieto, the governor of the state of Zulia. Additional sanctions on 6 Venezuelan military personnel were announced later. In terms of escalation ladder, it is important to keep in mind what is at the end of that ladder for the U.S. There is the world's largest estimated oil reserves located in the Orinoco Belt, which runs along the Orinoco River from the central state of Guarico all the way into the Atlantic. That comes from the article Washington's Escalation to Venezuela's Oil by Nino Paglicchia, posted March 6th. The colonized regimes anticipate the needs and demands of Washington and introduce resolutions on their behalf in regional organizations. In the case of Venezuela, they promote and organize regional bloc like the Lima Group to promote U.S.-led intervention. As Washington proceeds to destabilize Venezuela, the colonized allies recycle U.S. mass media propaganda and offer sanctuaries for opposition defectors and refugees. In sum, the recolonized elites facilitate domestic plunder and overseas conquests. Venezuela's success in resisting and defeating the U.S. drive for reconquest is the result of nationalist and socialist leaders who reallocate private wealth and redistribute public expenditures to the workers, peasants, and the unemployed. That comes from the article The Recolonization of Latin America and the War on Venezuela by Professor James Petras, posted March 6th. The editor here, various journalists and contributors, along with Global Justice to the Tax Justice Network, have been screaming for financial regulation because the banking industry is seriously damaging Britain, its prospects, and place in the world. The head of the National Crime Agency warns year after year of the economic and political threats that industrial-scale financial crime presents to Britain. And yet, over the last 40 years or so, Britain's economy and its failing tax system have been completely reconfigured to serve the interests of the rich who have offshored their wealth to ring-fence it away from contributing to the country of its extraction. No one, though, it seems, is prepared to fully challenge the sheer power of the City of London. The non-publication of the Sperry Report by the mainstream media that lays bare the realities of this monumental crime is surely evidence of that. That comes from the article, City of London, the Shocking Study No Mainstream Media Outlet Dared to Publish, by Robert Woodward, posted March 6, originally published at True Publica. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. March 8th marks the anniversary of the first U.S. troop arrival in Vietnam as part of a combat mission that would span the next decade and shatter America's sense of invulnerability and moral certitude. The unusual escalation of the war leading up to the 1965 invasion is of particular interest and evokes questions of who or what was driving the conflict and why. For a closer look at the motives of America's secret government in prosecuting the conflict, the Global Research NewsHour reach out to Professor Peter Dale Scott. Professor Scott is a former Canadian diplomat and English professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and a leading scholar on America's secret government. He's also a poet, writer, and researcher. His books include The War Conspiracy, JFK, 9/11, and the Deep Politics of War, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. We began our conversation with an overview of U.S. involvement in the Southeast Asian region.
From the second half of the 1950s under Eisenhower, there had been a buildup of pressure for America to assert itself militarily in the Third World And there were bureaucratic reasons for this, because the Army needed a role. Eisenhower believed in massive retaliation because it was cheap. You have a lot of nuclear weapons, and if Russia does something anywhere, well, you just make it clear that your reaction will be nuclear. It needed a mission, and they pushed very hard at first in Laos, and then also in Cuba, and didn't get what they wanted, so that's by default. And they wanted Vietnam. There were also economic reasons, because Southeast Asia, particularly Indonesia, was a source of oil and other minerals, gold and copper. They knew about what became, I think, the world's largest gold and copper mine in West Papua. They knew about that already in the late 50s. And then increasingly in the early 60s, before 1965, they were aware of oil in the offshore waters of Cambodia and Vietnam. So that added to the pressure. And Mobil, in particular, Mobil Oil, which is now part of Exxon, they were short on foreign oil reserves, and so they were lobbying very overtly for the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia. And one of their employees, a man called William Henderson, wrote a book on this topic. But William Henderson, he was also part of the American Friends of Vietnam, which was a lobby for intervention. But I think much more significantly, he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so you had the Army wanting a mission, and you had oil companies wanting intervention. But at a higher level, as I say in my book, The American Deep State, at this time, the kind of the brain of the American Deep State, at least the international faction of it, was the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And they had, since World War II or even before, demonstrated their real influence in determining U.S. foreign policy. They, for example, in 1952, they were talking about the need to do something in Guatemala, and the CIA didn't go really into do that until 54. And, of course, it was saving United Fruit in Guatemala. William Henderson was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations when he was doing this lobbying. And the Council on Foreign Relations generally was talking about the urgency of the crisis in Vietnam. And what is really significant, we see that they wanted intervention in 1963, and they got it. But also, when the war became exerted real pressure on U.S. gold reserves, and they actually essentially ran out in 1968, requiring new financial laws restricting the purchase and sale of gold in the United States. In that year, 68, the Council on Foreign Relations reversed direction and said, we need to tone down the war in Vietnam, and both Johnson and Nixon responded in the same way. So I think this is, I see this as a consensus of there are other aspects of the deep state, but the major part of it by far in the 1960s was the international faction, Wall Street, we often call it in New York, the law firms, the banks, etc. And also the big foundations, like Ford Foundation and so on, that there was a consensus for the war in 63. And now we come to the heart of your question. Kennedy, who had allowed, he had been pressured in 61 and a bit reluctantly. He was asked to do a number of things, but the two key ones were to send 8,000 troops in an advisory role to Vietnam, and also to make a commitment that we would save, we would not let Vietnam go communist. Well, he acceded to the first request, the 8,000 troops. Actually, it was the last request. The first request was the commitment. They said, this was a report submitted to him, that he should make this commitment, and all the other steps should only be made if he was willing to make the commitment. Well, he did send the 8,000 troops, but he would not make the commitment. And by 1963, he was quite disillusioned by what was happening. He had sent J.K. Galbraith to, he consulted with Kenneth Galbraith, a Canadian economist at Harvard, and Galbraith felt that it was time to start disengaging from Vietnam. And so Kennedy did a number of things in 63, which I think showed that he was breaking free of this sort of military, industrial, financial consensus that we needed to have to fight in Southeast Asia.
We know that he'd authorized withdrawal plans from Vietnam on October 11th of 63. And yes, there was quietly the National Security Action Memorandum 273 was put forward that overruled that decision, and it was approved, coincidentally, 2 days after Kennedy's assassination. So
yes,
that's
all of that's exactly right. Both there were two, we call them NASAMs, two National Security Action Memoranda. The first one was NASAM 263, and that was October. And that it called specifically the bulk of troops out by 65, but immediately you had to prepare to get 1,000 troops out by the end of 1963 as a first step. Now, NASAM 273 was drafted very carefully so that it was not conspicuous what was happening. But it did talk about maintaining aid at the same level as before, and it quietly annulled the withdrawal of the 1,000 troops. There had been, I think, 220 troops who had already been prepared to come home. By the way, that announcement, it was publicly announced that there would be a withdrawal of 1,000 troops, and it was announced on November 20th, which was 2 days before the assassination. And 2 days after the assassination, it's quite clear that there was never anything after those 220 troops. So that first step of getting the troops out was annulled. Now, this issue is often talked about in the wrong way. People say, well, we don't know what Kennedy would have done. That's not the question. He had authorized a withdrawal, and the authorization, as you said, by NASAM 273, it's dated November 26th, which is 4 days after the assassination. But the meeting that agreed to it was on November 24th, which was 2 days after. It was the day that Oswald was being shot in Dallas. So it was a very swift reversal. And I think that we can't just leave it at that. We have to remember that Kennedy had a larger sort of geostrategic projection for the future, so that we mustn't forget that on June the 10th, he had made this important speech at American University in Washington, where he said, "We are all mortal, and that we have to learn to live with Russia and not run the risk of, have to calm down the risks of a nuclear confrontation that they had just been through." So he had a definite change of plan in Vietnam, which deferred him from the Council on Foreign Relations. But I think even more serious, perhaps, was this threat to take down to diminish the Cold War, because after all, America had been on a militarized economy since World War II, And we're still in that militarized economy in 2019.
What about Johnson? Because he's often seen, even among those who question the official account of the Kennedy assassination, he's seen or portrayed sometimes as a co-conspirator because he pushed the land war. Do you see him as in that light, or is he, or do you have a more, I don't know, conciliatory attitude to as far as Johnson's going forward with this plan?
Well, that's a very, very good question, and I may disappoint you when I tell you that my mind is open on that topic, because on the one hand, as you said, there's no doubt that discussions inside the White House that Johnson had been a supporter of a more vigorous intervention in Vietnam. And he made that very clear. And that we, for what we know of the meeting on Sunday the 24th, it's quite clear that Johnson said he had wanted. I don't think we heard him on the actual topic of withdrawal, but we did hear him saying that he wanted a more vigorous effort. But I'm not sure that exactly means he wanted a hot war. And you know, there's a book, this is a history book, that there was a meeting in December when he said to the generals, you helped me get re-elected in 64, and then I will give you your goddamn war. Something we haven't mentioned is that the Saigon government began to get a very bad image in the American media in 63 because of problems with the Buddhists, who were objecting to. Diem was a Catholic. His brother No Diem Nu, who ran the party, was a Catholic. Another brother was the Archbishop of Hue. They were from North Vietnam, a Catholic family, and the vast majority of the country was Buddhist, and the Buddhists were protesting in 63. One of them burned himself alive on television in protest. So the Saigon government was both in trouble domestically and also in trouble in American public opinion. And Johnson, I think, didn't want to be fazed by that. But yes, I will say I'm clear that he wanted to sustain a U.S. advisory role in Vietnam. I think that he would have been for the Tonkin Gulf incidents. The first incident was real but trivial. It was U.S.-induced. It was a U.S. provocation, no question. The so-called second Tonkin Gulf incident 2 days later, when PT boats are supposed to have attacked destroyers, was nonsense from the beginning, and there was it was a genuine impression in the big Gulf of Tonkin on the destroyers, but in fact it wasn't real. But he was very happy to have that. I think primarily he ran as a peace candidate in order to get elected and defeat Goldwater, who was the overt hawk. But I think his heart was really in his domestic program, that he wanted to be remembered favorably as the author of the Civil Rights Act, which he really basically was. I do not think anybody in 63, 64 believed that they were going to get into the kind of war that they did get into. And Johnson in particular, I think, would have. This is all counter-historical, but I don't think he was eager to have this kind of the kind of war that ensued at all.
You use the term war conspiracy, which you define as the sustained resort to collusion and conspiracies, unauthorized provocations and fraud by U.S. personnel, particularly intelligence personnel, all with the aim of sustaining military commitments in Asia. So I have to ask here in 2019, what would you say is the state of the war conspiracy? Has it advanced? Is it still with us in a different form? Or how would you assess its status today?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because You're quoting stuff that I wrote back in 1969, 1970, and that was the germ of my thinking about deep politics, which then induced me to start using in 2006 for America the term deep state, which is now taken off and is being used in ways I never intended. I think what has evolved here is my own thinking. The word conspiracy is so loaded with connotations that I don't mind being called a conspiracy theorist because, yes, I do think Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy. I do think 9/11 was a conspiracy, and I don't think it was a conspiracy of 19 Arabs. I think it was a higher-level conspiracy. These things can be debated, but in my book, The American Deep State, I try to give a picture of the evolution that you were asking me about through the years since, and I think that the period 1960 to 1980 was a period of contention between all the presidents of that era and what I would call the deep state, and particularly the CIA, which is a kind of quasi. It's hard to characterize the CIA because it's not formally part of the constitutionally established government, but it exercises power both abroad and at home, which is certainly competitive with the power of the Pentagon and the power of other State Department and so on. Kennedy had trouble with the CIA after the Bay of Pigs. He didn't trust the CIA. Johnson had trouble with the Pentagon because they wanted to win and win quickly. And although Johnson sent hundreds of thousands of troops to Vietnam, in the end, he was not agreeing to the level they wanted in 68. They wanted, I think, 600,000 more troops. And that was the year when everybody, including the Council on Foreign Relations, said, no, enough is enough. The U.S. gold reserves are drying up. So he said no, and he couldn't run for a second term, which is how many incumbents have not run for a second term? It's a very unusual thing. Nixon had terrible problems with the CIA and had to resign. Carter had terrible problems with the CIA, and it's, from my perspective, quite clear that in the so-called October surprise problem that Carter had in 79-80, he was trying to get you had a bunch of Americans were being held hostage in Iran, and he was trying to get them out, and the Republicans were plotting behind his back with active CIA people helping them to prevent the hostages coming home until Reagan became president. And they very spectacularly were released and came on the day of Reagan's inauguration in 1980. So all those presidents had problems, and since then we have not seen that kind of problem, except maybe today. Trump is something else, but up until Trump, I would say essentially the deep state won. And you did not have presidents opposing the deep state. And again, I'm saying nothing about Trump, but up until Trump, that was the end of those two decades of trouble between the presidency and the deep state, with some pretty spectacular events, four major political assassinations, which is not normally the American way of running your politics, but was becoming almost predictable in that period. We still have the basic problems. We still have a deep state. We still have a military-industrial complex. We still have an economy which is not a normal civil economy, but depends very much on the petrodollar, which needs U.S. forces abroad to enforce it, and military budgets and military expenditures, which oil and arms are America's chief exports. This must change, but it hasn't changed. And as I say, the only one who really wanted to change that was Kennedy.
Professor Peter Dale Scott, it's been a tremendous privilege and honor to have you on the show and elaborate on these themes. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Professor Peter Dale Scott, author, former Canadian diplomat and English professor, and leading scholar of the U.S. deep state. He joined us from Berkeley. You can find a list of his writings at his site, www.peterdalescott.net.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
The other major preoccupation of the Johnson presidency, besides Vietnam, was the domestic upheaval around civil rights and racial injustice in the United States. Were there significant synergies and correlations between the war abroad and the black freedom struggle at home? Joining us to address this question is Abayomi Azikiwe. He's the editor of Pan-African Newswire, the online press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. He's also a frequent contributor to Global Research. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Abayomi.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Now, you noted in a February 2018 article that not only did opposition to the war by leading figures within the civil rights and black nationalist movement far precede the better-known white student-led Vietnam War protests, but the more advanced elements enacted concrete actions in solidarity with North Vietnam and the NLF. Could you outline the common cause articulated by those elements at that time between the Southern freedom struggles in the United States and opposition to the war?
First of all, it's important to note that people of African descent in the United States are an oppressed nation. The reason why I have reached this conclusion is that they were never given full citizenship inside the United States after the conclusion of the Civil War. There was the 1857 Dred Scott decision, which said that the black man has no right that the white man is bound to respect. Even after the period of Reconstruction and the passage of numerous constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, right along with Civil Rights Acts of 1866, 1875, and so forth, still, within a matter of years, African-Americans were being subjected to conditions that are quite similar to slavery. So in that sense, the struggle here is a national liberation struggle, as well as a struggle for full equality, since people were born in the United States, even those who weren't born, who are naturalized citizens, at the same time still have a right to fundamental equality, due process before the law, and actual legal representation. So in that sense, there was a historic synergy between the struggle of the Vietnamese people and the African-American people. Historically, Ho Chi Minh, the man who became Ho Chi Minh, who led the Vietnamese Revolution for decades, had spent time in the United States and had observed and even written on the plight of the African-American people as early as the 1920s. So in this regard, you had people such as Malcolm X, later the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which put out probably the first statement within the civil rights movement opposing U.S. intervention in Vietnam. And then, of course, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, who had issued their statement in January of 1966. And eventually, by the following year, 1967, Dr. Martin Luther King, who was president and co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, came out strongly against the war So, these are foundational events that actually set the stage for a much broader opposition to the war after 1967.
You just mentioned Ho Chi Minh. Do you get the sense that his own involvement in the Vietnam resistance struggle was fueled by what he saw in America? I mean, beyond this sort of generic empathy for the victims of empire.
Yes, I believe so. When he saw the depth of the oppression and brutality and repression against the African-American people, of course, this fueled his commitment to liberate what was then known as Indochina. And he went on to be involved in the formation of the Indochinese Communist Party in the early 1930s, which eventually became the Vietnamese Communist Party and the Workers' Party of Vietnam. But Ho Chi Minh was a central figure in the 20th century movement against imperialism. The fact that you had a small nation like Vietnam that was able to organize to defeat French imperialism during the mid-1950s and later stood its ground against U.S. imperialism and defeated it in 1975. And today is a country that is sovereign, that even has solicited cooperation, has been solicited by the United States in terms of its negotiations with the Democratic Republic of Korea, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So, yeah, I think Ho Chi Minh's visit to the United States and his ongoing efforts in Vietnam, his response in the 1960s to the African-American civil rights movement and liberation struggle, I think, is clearly interrelated.
Now, you just also mentioned opposition of Martin Luther King expressed in 1967, which, as if memory serves, was very controversial. Support for the war early on was quite broad spread, especially after the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So could you maybe speak to the issue of whether the involvement of the more radical elements complicated in any way efforts to mobilize a broader anti-war movement?
No, I don't think so. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Now, he had made gestures or overtures to the civil rights movement. He had introduced a civil rights bill, which got very little traction until the ascendancy of Lyndon Johnson after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It is reported, and there is a national security memorandum, which suggests that Kennedy was working towards a gradual withdrawal of, quote, advisors, unquote, from Vietnam. And this was in 1963. There were, I believe, several thousand so-called advisors in Vietnam, but they were actually there to try to prop up the regime in Saigon. Then, of course, after Kennedy's assassination, we saw, as you mentioned, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which occurred around the time of the Democratic National Convention in 1964. And then with the election of Lyndon Johnson in November of 1964 by a landslide, by March, some 54 years ago this month, there was a major escalation in U.S. Military deployment in Vietnam. And this coincided with the Selma to Montgomery March, whole push towards universal suffrage in the United States, and it was just a contradiction that could not be sustained. You had urban rebellions that began right after the signing of the Voting Rights Act in August of 1965 in Los Angeles, and then there was the rebellions in 1966-67, which reached well over 160 cities in 1967. So, yes, Johnson made the wrong decision to continue the war in Vietnam, and it came at the expense of any commitment to eliminate poverty or to ensure full civil rights for African Americans in the United States.
Now, within the context of a revolutionary story, you wrote that the Black Panther Party leader, Bobby Seale, had attended a conference in Montreal, Quebec, in late 1968, where the NLF representatives recognized the party as the vanguard of the revolutionary movement in the U.S. What role do you believe the Black Panther Party's and the NLF's solidarity played in the eventual demise of the Black Panther Party at the hands of the FBI?
Yeah, this was a tremendous story. It's documented in the Black Panther newspaper from that time period, late 1968, early 1969. And yes, the solidarity was extremely strong. Elders Cleaver, even though he became quite controversial, had been in exile in Algeria, and there he had met the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese actually had turned over their embassy to the Black Panther Party International section in 1969 during the Pan-African Cultural Festival in Algiers. Also, Cleaver traveled with a delegation from the United States while he was in exile in Algeria to Vietnam in 1970, and that was documented as well in the Black Panther newspaper of the period. In 1969, during the Chicago 8 trial, these were 8 people who were indicted for conspiring to disrupt the Democratic National Convention in 1968. Bobby Seale was one of the defendants. He was later removed from the case, bound and gagged, tortured right in the courtroom. And during that period, one of the other defendants, Rennie Davis, had gotten a communication from the Democratic People's Republic of Vietnam and the National Liberation Front in the South, indicating that Vietnam was willing to exchange U.S. political prisoners for the release of Huey P. Newton, who was in jail in California, connected with his conviction for the killing of a police officer in Oakland in 1967, and also Bobby Seale, who was also imprisoned, was on trial, and also facing charges related to the killing of Alex Rackley in New Haven, Connecticut in 1969. So this shows the degree of political clout that the Black Panther Party had during that period, the fact that the principal military enemy of the United States during that period, being North Vietnam and the resistance in the South, offered to exchange U.S. prisoners that they had captured on the battlefield for the release of leading members of the Black Panther Party. So that in and of itself is a representation of how much the Vietnamese identify with the Black Liberation Movement in the United States.
Now, finally, we're of course, living in a period now with the election of Trump, we're seeing a heightened hypervigilance around racial inequality and racialized violence and oppression at the same time as suggestions of increased militarism around the world. Do you believe that the struggles of the 1960s have any lessons for people organizing today?
I think they have tremendous lessons. The necessity for a national organization that is anti-racist, anti-capitalist, and anti-imperialist. Also, the fact that you have to take a principal position, you have to move towards independent, radical, and revolutionary politics and organizing. I think these are the lessons that will be well taken here in the second decade of the 21st century. We've seen the rise of spontaneous movements in relationship to police killings of African Americans. We've seen an upsurge in the low-wage labor movement inside the United States. But these movements need to be informed by a revolutionary organizational force that can not only determine various positions on a local national level, but also on an international level. And that is a lesson, I believe, of the Black Panther Party and other revolutionary groups such as the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which started here in Detroit, and the Republic of New Africa, which also started here in Detroit.
Abiyomi Azikiwe, it's always great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for your analysis.
And thank you.
We've been speaking with Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire. He joined us from Detroit.
The escalation of the Vietnam War was enabled by the infamous Gulf of Tonkin incident, in which it was reported by the U.S. media that three North Vietnamese torpedo boats opened fire on two U.S. destroyers. Years later, the episode would be exposed as a hoax to fuel the outrage of the U.S. public and justify the U.S. military's war plans, including the 1965 ground war. A false flag, in other words. Barry Zwicker is a media critic and worked as a newspaper writer for the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, and the Detroit News, among other publications, during the Vietnam War period. Barry began to have a dissident view of the war after reviewing the writings of I.F. Stone in 1959 and 1960 while attending the University of Michigan. As both a writer for the Globe and an anti-war activist, he gained unique insights into how media worked to obscure the truth about U.S. state violence. The Global Research NewsHour reached out to Barry to get his impressions of how media was reporting the Gulf of Tonkin incident and the war generally.
Well, it's one of the worst false flags. The alleged Gulf of Tonkin incident. And the reason was, or is, that it was on the basis of this alleged incident way off on the other side of the world that the U.S. president introduced the Tonkin Gulf resolution to the U.S. Senate. It all happened in a matter of about 3 days, and the U.S. Senate voted 88-2 in favor of that resolution. Was the basis of the whole U.S. war on Vietnam and all the lives that were lost and so forth thereafter. So this was a tremendously significant false flag operation. And I might mention here, and it's by way of explanation about what happened and why it was so important, is that Benjamin Bradlee, the legendary managing editor of the Washington Post for many years. It was 32 years ago, actually, in 1987, that Bradlee delivered the first James Cameron Memorial Lecture in London, England. Here's how Bradlee actually opened that lecture. He says, "I would like to talk about government lying, calculated lies, the willful deception of the public for political ends, especially under the guise of national security, and what an awful price we pay for such lies under any name, misinformation, disinformation, deceit, deception, or just plain dishonesty." And I would add that in his lecture, he never used the term false flag operations, but false flag operations just about cover all the words he used. And he went on to say, "I'm not talking about little lies." He says, "Let's talk about the big lies, the lies that change history." And, of course, this is where the Tonkin Gulf false flag operation rises up in all its horror. And here's what Bradlee said when he blew the whistle on this alleged incident in his now famous lecture. And he pointed out an August 1964 issue of Time magazine, and he quoted from that issue. These are the words from Time magazine. "Through the darkness from the west and south, the intruders boldly sped. There were at least six of them, Russian-designed Swato gunboats armed with 37-millimeter and 28-millimeter guns and P-4s. At 9:52, they opened fire on the destroyers with automatic weapons, and this time from as close as 2,000 yards. The night glowed eerily with the nightmarish glare of air-dropped flares and boats' searchlights. Two of the enemy boats went down." Now, Bradley, quoting from Time magazine. Bradley goes on and says, "That's the kind of vivid detail that the news magazines have made famous. I don't mean to single out Time," Bradley said. "On the same date, Life said almost the same thing. And that week's issue of Newsweek had torpedoes whipping by, U.S. ships blazing out salvo after salvo of shelves. It had a PT boat bursting into flames." And then Bradley concludes, "There was only one trouble. There was no battle. There was not a single intruder, never mind six of them. Never mind Russian-designed SWATO gunboats armed with 37-millimeter and 28-millimeter guns. They never opened fire. They never sank. They never fired torpedoes. They never were." And it has taken 20 years for this truth to emerge.
Thanks for that that reference, Barry. Just finally, I wanted to get your take about the broader tone of media coverage around the Vietnam War, in particular Canadian media coverage.
There was in the Globe and Mail, as there had been in the New York Times, a lot of reportage from Vietnam, which detailed some brutalities, but the thing is that these details were never referred to in editorials as being horrible. They stuck with these generalities about communism was taking over Asia and all that kind of ideological cant. The editorial slant and, of course, the omissions, the failure to really highlight these atrocities affected the whole of the public. So that those of us in the public, we had to get our information, yes, to some extent from the newspapers and to a certain extent from television and radio, but the newspapers continued just to be basically in favor of what we now know is American imperialism of the worst kind. So that was the general picture I saw. And I remember one time my wife and I were marching in an anti-Vietnam War parade here in Toronto, and of course we ended up in front of the American consulate on University Avenue, and there were a lot of us. It was very peaceful, and there were a lot of us. And so I looked up at the steps at the front of the U.S. consulate, and there's a bunch of American officials, and there are American security people, and there are Canadian policemen. And standing right there with them were two of my fellow Globe and Mail staffers chatting amiably with the American officials and the Canadian policemen and the American security people, my own fellow staff members. And that's bad enough, but what went through my mind right at the time, there's thousands of people down here. There's housewives, there's professors, there's children, there's auto mechanics, there's insurance salesmen, a lot of us. Why aren't they down here interviewing us? And that really shook me, and it showed me how my own mainstream medium, the Globe and Mail, was not performing properly. But give the Globe and Mail credit, I never ran into any problem because I was an anti-Vietnam War marcher. So I certainly give the Globe and Mail credit for that.
But certainly that's an interesting comment on some of the systemic issues surrounding that. But Barry Zwicker, we really appreciate your insights. Thank you so much for checking in.
Well, you're welcome. And I appreciated being asked because it made me delve further into my own memories and my own information about that era, and it helps me in writing my memoirs.
Okay. Well, look forward to seeing those. We've been speaking with Barry Zwicker, Toronto-based author and media critic.
Professor Michel Chossudovsky is an award-winning author, professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa, and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He had a chance to visit Vietnam in the 1990s at the invitation of the Ministry of Agriculture. He relayed to this program his impressions of the country's lack of advancement 2 decades after the country's victory over the U.S. and charted the trajectory of the country's development to today.
What struck me was, in fact, the total collapse of the achievements of the socialist project, so to speak. The wages were abysmally low. Health services had collapsed. And also there were secret negotiations taking place which were conditional to the normalization of U.S. Vietnam relations, which pertained to issues of debt and macroeconomic reform. Essentially, what they were doing was imposing the neoliberal agenda and also, and that's important, demanding war reparations to the United States, not war reparations to Vietnam. And that took place in a very convoluted way. Now, I think more recently, if we look at the balance sheet of development since the mid-90s, what is Vietnam today? Well, it's an impoverished country. It's a cheap labor haven for the delocation of manufacturing. It is an ally, a military ally of the United States. In other words, the United States goes in, commits war crimes, kills people, and then they insert Vietnam into their zone of influence. And just to put it in perspective, the minimum wage in Vietnam today is 20 cents an hour. So in effect, what has happened is that the whole project of post-colonial sovereignty has been annulled or cancelled, even though Vietnam actually won that war.
So there's the insertion of IMF structural adjustment programs that effectively conquered the country.
Well, yes, in stages, but there were debt negotiations which took place. There was, as I mentioned, war reparations. Actually, it was via the Paris Club. I had the opportunity of interviewing a key personality whose name is Nguyen Xian Ong, who was economic advisor to the Prime Minister of South Vietnam, who was actually involved in the negotiations. He was a former IMF official, and he was also Minister of Finance under the military government during the war period, General Duong Van Minh. I got from this interview, I got a perspective of how they manipulated and how they actually inserted Vietnam into the nexus of debt. Conditional lending on the part of the IMF and the World Bank.
Okay. Now, briefly, if you could, do you see the Vietnam model, as you call it, having relevance today in the era of Donald Trump?
Well, you know, the Vietnam model is an acceptance of the post-colonial, or in fact, neo-colonial American model. You can see it in Southeast Asia. You can see it in Sub-Saharan Africa. What is it? It's the Philippines. It's Cambodia. It's Vietnam. It's Indonesia. Impoverished populations serving as cheap labor. That is the Vietnam model. Now, this notion of the Vietnam model has come to the forefront with the negotiations between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump in Hanoi. But bear in mind, if we look at North Korea today, it has a higher standard of living in terms of basic indicators, literacy, and health than the United States of America. And those are official figures of the United Nations. It has a 99% literacy rate. The United States has 86%. It has full coverage, health coverage, universal health and education. Now, we may dislike North Korea, but they have achieved something which these other countries, these Vietnam model countries of Southeast Asia, have never reached, and that is a decent standard of living.
Well, you can find Michelle Chesedovsky's article, Neoliberalism and the Vietnam Model, Who Won the Vietnam War, at the website globalresearch.ca. Michelle Chesedovsky, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
We've been joined by Professor Michelle Chesedovsky. He is the editor of Global Research and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.